Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. So much to get to. You know, I was on the way over here, and I'm going, man, there's just so much going on, and not enough time to get to everything. I mean, with everything going on with the IRS, everything going on in the Ukraine and Crimea, CPAC. Yes, the CPAC conference in D.C. I wish I could go. Really, everybody loves a good circus, right? You know, the kids love the circus. They love the clowns and the people doing the acrobatics and the guy in the cage with the bikes and they just love the peanuts and the atmosphere, the circus. Who doesn't love a circus? And that's basically what CPAC has turned into. Now, look, I understand at the beginning the idea is that you go, hey, you know, we want to bring our ideas together. We want to, we want to network with each other, see what best practices are, see what's working in, and who knows where, and come together with some ideas. Ideas! Oh, wow, there's something the Republican Party has forgotten all about. The idea people. And, but CPAC for me is now, it's just this big circus. I have to believe at some point it was about ideas. And I look at the current Republican Party and with the clown show going on, the big moneyed, well-funded, billionaire-attended clown show. But I look at it and I go, here could be an opportunity for some sanity, some reality. Just a thought. Maybe bringing the party back to its roots. I know they love to talk about Lincoln, or the party of Lincoln, and the party of Eisenhower, and the party of Reagan. Well, what those folks had? Vision. They had ideas. You go through each one of them, did something pretty decent for the country. And I look at this, and the current party is all about destruction. The current party is all about no. The current Republican Party is all about destroying the institutions that have been built up over the years because it's bad and we don't like it and the billionaires can't make money off of it. So it seems. And, the best line I think I've heard about the CPAC conference was from a guy over at Yahoo News, who pointed out that the whole thing feels like an episode of The Americans, minus the intrigue and likable characters. And what I find interesting is that's kind of it. There's really nobody likable there anymore. I mean, Chris Christie, not so much. Marco Rubio, not at all. Donald Trump, certainly not. And you go down the list, and it kind of makes you go, Now, here's the thing that you're not going to get out of CPAC. I mean, it's a circus, and we'll enjoy the show as it's going on. But we won't get any vision, any competent vision for the future, any coherent thoughts on what tomorrow is going to look like. And I ask my conservative friends this quite often. In your worldview, what role does government play? Because understand, you have to have some role for government, because if you don't, you will have chaos. You will have corporate control, which I argue we already do for the most part. We've got probably the best government money can buy by our billionaire class. But for me, this idea that you actually need to have a platform. And you go back and you read some of the old Republican Party platforms, there were some decent ideas. And I guess the question I have to ask is a platform of even lower taxes, even more deregulation, even more control of corporations, is that a viable future? Is that a viable philosophy? Is it a viable ideology? Is it the way that we, the people, really think we should going.
It turns out that the director of the movie Noah, starring Russell Crowe, found out after the fact that Paramount Pictures had appended a disclaimer to the movie. Why? Because the weird little snake handling, floor rolling, tongue speaking, strychnine swigging are having a hissy about the movie Noah, which I kind of find it, oh well. Why are they having a hissy? Oh dear. Apparently, director Aronofsky, Darren Aronofsky, only found out after it had become a fait accompli that Paramount is adding a religious disclaimer to the film. And they're putting the disclaimer on all the marketing materials. Why? Because the national religious broadcasters got their maiden forms in a bunch. Over the content of the film. The national religious broadcasters now have the power to bring the Paramount studio to its knees. In order, this is fundy appeasement. So apparently the disclaimers, based on what Paramount said, this film is inspired by the story of Noah. While artistic license has been taken, we believe that this film is true to the essence, values, and integrity of a story that is a cornerstone of faith for millions of people worldwide. The biblical story of Noah can be found in the book of Genesis.
What, Edith?
Okay, Genesis chapter 6. I think we're going to have to go and examine. And yeah, there's important stuff going on in the world today, but this just pisses me off. Let's see. And it came to pass, things were always coming to pass back there in Genesis, when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, 6 times 12 is 72, and daughters were born unto them. Huh? What? Stop it. This is not prayer meeting Wednesday, but just stop it. And it came to pass when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, and daughters were born unto them. Because before then there hadn't been any daughters, it was all just Cains and Abels. And they are what? How are they having their traditional family values, marriages between one man and one woman, if they hadn't had daughters yet? The sons of... that's a curious phrase, isn't it? Saw the daughters of men that they were fair. And they took them wives of all which they chose. And the Lord said, my spirit shall not always strive with man, for that he also is flesh, yet his days shall be 120 years. That was back before they understood calendars, or wheelbarrows, or why it rained, or that the earth revolves around the sun, not vice versa. So you go, yada, 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 verse 6, verse 7, God gets pissed off, he's going to kill everybody on the planet, because, you know, he's like that. But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. Noah was a just man and perfect in his generations. Noah walked with God. And he had three sons. Shem, Ham, and Japheth. The earth was also corrupt before God. The earth was filled with violence. Yada, yada, yada. Remember, this is all bogarted from... There is not an original word in Genesis. It was all bogarted from somewhere else. So, you know, go and build an ark, yada, yada, yada. Okay. So the ark gets built, right? And the floodwaters come, and the unicorn, poor little unicorns die. Right. It's in what happens after that things get interesting. Because that's the part where Noah's sons get daddy liquored up, and then Noah's sons have sex with daddy. Ew. I mean, really.
Ew.
So, the fact that the National Religious Broadcasters Association, Coven, Claven, what have you, is upset about, and why? Well, according to the rap, prominent Christian activists and scholars, really Christian activists and scholars, that's hilarious, out there marching about a movie while the people that their savior said they should be taking care of keep starving and freezing to death and burning in fires. And yes, prominent Christian activists and scholars have expressed concern about Aronofsky's retelling of one of the most famous stories and the most sacred text in the Western world from inception. Huh? Most sacred text in the Western world from its inception? I'm sorry. No, the Iliad and the Odyssey were quite equally sacred in that cult. Yes. That book has not been that sacred for that long. The criticism began more than a year ago when an older version of the script leaked. Imagine that, a movie about Noah and something leaked. After reading a copy, Brian Godawa, no, really, who works over there at that place that was run by that Breitbart guy who is mercifully dead. He's having a hissy. Godawa is. If you were expecting a biblically faithful retelling of the story of the greatest mariner in history, huh? And a tale of redemption and obedience to God, you'd be sorely disappointed. Noah paints the primeval world of Genesis 6 as scorched or arid desert, dry, cracked earth, and a gray, gloomy sky that gives no rain, and all this caused by man's disrespect for the environment. In short, an anachronistic doomsday scenario of ancient global warming. Oh, dear, that can't be good. Oh, so it goes on and on and on. The fundies are pissed off. But this is my favorite part. Ken Ham. Now, wait, back up. The National Religious Broadcasters board member Phil Cook was interviewed by the RAP, and he said that they had to demand, the religious broadcasters making demands of a movie theater, or a movie studio. Gotta love it. Taliban much? Theocracy often? He said they had to have the disclaimer because the story as portrayed in the movie Noah is historically inaccurate. Huh? How can something that isn't historical be historically inaccurate? Excuse me? It's a myth. It's not even an original myth invented by the people who wrote it down. They got it from somewhere else and repackaged it. Oh, God. It's historically inaccurate. I mean, everybody knows. I mean, for instance, their CGI ark is clearly made of oak when we all know that history tells us that it was made of gopher wood. pity's sakes. Okay, so that's bad enough. Now, Ken Ham, noted Australian science denier and Husser who created the Answers in Genesis Creationism Museum. Hoo-wee. He said, the film's not at all faithful to the biblical account in Genesis. It's a Hollywood con. It's trying to lure unsuspecting Jews and Christians to an unbiblical production. I mean, Noah's family only consists of his wife, three sons, and one daughter-in-law, contrary to the Bible. It appears as if every species was crammed in the ark instead of just the kinds of animals, thus mocking the ark account in the same way secularists do today. Noah does not have a relationship with God, but rather with circumstances and his deadly visions of the flood. And the ark lands on a cliff next to a beach. Because Ken Ham knows where the ark landed. We discussed this. The Godawa Crete doesn't like the way Russell Crowe portrays Noah. Noah's a kind of rural shaman and vegan hippie-like gatherer of herbs. Noah explains that his family tries to study and heal the world whenever possible, like a kind of environmentalist scientist. Remember, this guy writes for White Fart. Yeah. This is being pitched as history in the United States of America, and there just aren't enough of us normal people to go, shut them up. There's no way this is history. Tim from L.A., what's the big stink about Noah, let alone the entire Old Testament? I mean, unless you're Jewish, the death and resurrection of Jesus the zombie helped create the new covenant, and what is old is now new. So the big stink about Noah shouldn't be a big deal. Also, if these right-wing fundies read their book of myth, the bolt thrower created a rainbow. Is the sky spook gay? To try to make a promise that he would never flood the earth again. So by making a big stink, wouldn't that piss off Jesus' dad after he murdered all those poor people? Maybe these Christians need to shut their damn mouths up? I pray, I yearn for the day. And, of course, Marty tells me Qatar, Bahrain, the UAE, all of them are banning Noah from even being screened in their countries, with Egypt, Jordan, and Kuwait expected to follow suit. Okay. Yeah, I had a feeling that line would get to Dr. John. The greatest mariner in history? So the movie Noah is a John Paul Jones biopic? Or about the guy that shot the albatross? There. Two candidates for the greatest mariner in history. Neither of which is the drunken dude in the tent. Hey, son, come here. Bring me another goat skin full of that Merlot. No, son, really, get away. I don't want to do that. May have to go out and borrow another cup of vomit. It just goes on like that. And of course, getting away from that foolishness. You know all about, by now, the sleazy business with what Daryl Issa did to Elijah Cummings in a House Oversight Committee hearing yesterday. It cut off his mic, did everything but spit on him. Really showed himself to be the sleazy freak that we know him to be. Well, it's not sitting too well to see one of the elder statesmen of the Congress thus so poorly treated. And the Congressional Black Caucus has written a letter to John Boehner, who does not have the spine to do much of anything at all, demanding that Daryl Issa, unindicted co-conspirator, near felon, that Daryl Issa, and the people in his district personally responsible for sending him to the Congress in the first place. I mean, the pickle barrel's got to be pretty well damn nigh empty when the best you can do is Daryl Issa. But no, Daryl Issa abused Representative Elijah Cummings of Maryland quite thoroughly. I mean, it really was. It was shameful. I'm sure most of you have seen it, heard it by now. Representative Marsha Fudge wrote a letter to John Boehner demanding that he reprimand Daryl Issa and take away the chairmanship of the Oversight Committee, which would, in fact, be a fine idea. But he ain't gonna. Boehner said, I think he was within his rights to do what he did. Daryl Issa is his chairman. He's been an effective chairman, and I support him. Yeah, like you'd expect anything different from John Boehner. Marsha Fudge then retorted, "The abuse of authority and misuse of the congressional privileges afforded them are an affront to the expectations of the American public. Congressman Daryl Issa of California abused his authority and therefore must be reprimanded to ensure the dignity of the House of Representatives is preserved." I agree in principle with Representative Fudge. It's about as tawdry a display of raw aggression, maybe passive aggression, I don't know quite how we're defining that these days, to see what Issa did. But I have to take issue with a couple of Marsha Fudge's premises. And one is that the American people expect something else, something better from the Congress. The latest polling, as it has for, 4 years now, shows that the American public doesn't think much at all of Congress and has no real expectations of Congress beyond expecting the Repiglicans to continue to wallow in their own filth as they have been doing. And then Marsha Fudge's assertion that Issa must be reprimanded to ensure the dignity of the House of Representatives is preserved. To preserve something, the thing being preserved must first exist. There is no dignity in the majority, the jackbooted majority in the House of Representatives. They have no dignity. They have their front feet in the trough, and the only thing they're interested in is seeing how quickly they can get the back feet into the trough, too. And, of course, we've seen this before. John Conyers. Huh. Why is it always a dark-skinned member of the Congress who's getting abused by some pale member of the Republican Party? Because John Conyers had this done to him several years back. I remember, back during the dark and miserable days of the George W. Bush misadministration. No, that wasn't a misadministration. That was a maladministration. There's a difference. But how can we ensure dignity in a House of Representatives that has none? How can you preserve that which does not exist? If there was any dignity, if the American people could expect anything of the Congress of the United States, yes, Daryl Issa would be stripped of his chairmanship and he would be publicly censured for his... imagine that. Calling a hearing and not allowing anything except his own cherry-picked inquiry. Witnesses excused. Yeah, after I asked a couple of questions, I said the witness is excused. You need to shut up. Shut up! I'm biting. Yeah. Then, of course, that whole interlude didn't sit too well with Sergey via email, noting dignity, preserve the dignity of the House of Representatives. Sorry, Representative Fudge, but that train left the station years ago. Yes, it did. Oh, it was Irish Dave, a strongly worded missive. Irish Dave, now wait just a gall darn minute. Going back to the whole Noah thing, the non-kosher ham is from the land down under and has yet to answer the question: did Noah have only two kangaroos on his big boat? Well, no, he had kinds of animals, not animals themselves, kinds of animals. So maybe he didn't have. Maybe he didn't have two roos. He may have had a pair of wallabies. Wait a minute. They'd have to evolve into kangaroos then, wouldn't they? And they went hoppity-hoppity-hippity-hoppity all the way from Ararat up over to Australia. Go figure. Now, going back real quick to... The ISA issue. Bless her heart, one of my favorite members of Congress, Representative Louise Slaughter of New York, one of the original co-sponsors and one of the first people to jump on board with the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Act, H.R. 526. She had a little something to say about the shenanigans as put forth by Darrell ISA. Thanks very much to Shorty from L.A. for sending this in. Check out Louise Slaughter.
Introduce the terrific ranking member of, the Rules Committee. Louise Slaughter has been a champion of your side.
Oh, thank you so much. Good morning. I'm delighted to be here with my friends this morning. We have sort of reached the boiling point. And I want to say to you, because none of you look particularly interested in what we're doing up here, that this is really an important piece of work we're talking about here today, because democracy is under threat. What has happened in this place week after week in the House of Representatives is nothing short of legislative malpractice. The Congress of the United States used to be the gold standard of legislatures. And we went by Jefferson's manuals year after year after year, Congress after Congress, doing what we could in making this the most incredible country on earth. And now what are we doing? I want to give you numbers. I'm going to be brief and talk about it. What happened yesterday to Ranking Member Cummings, this is the first time I think that ranking members have gotten together to complain. What happened was so outrageous, so demeaning, so unjudicial, so awful in every respect, that we just absolutely have reached the boiling point. I have been up for it. You all, if you pay attention at all to rules, which is a pretty powerful committee, you know that I've been telling you for years here, the last 2 years anyway, that every week we are here, the estimated cost, please write this down, the estimated cost of running the House of Representatives for 1 week is $24 million. Okay? Now, the first 33 times that we voted to kill the health care bill, it took 80 hours of legislative work and cost of about $48 million. So it's gone way beyond that now. What happened, you've heard about the IRS, was that all the money that they have been spent for nothing. Because we don't do legislation that is intended to ever become law in this land, and I think secretly many of them are glad for that, but because we come here, 435 of us are brought here every week to do what basically amounts to a press release. Please pay some attention to that. The public needs to know. If you have a House of Representatives that talks about nothing but cost, nothing but spending, that will take away food stamps, that thinks it's immoral to help with unemployment insurance, but is throwing money away by the buckets full on a useless legislative process here that goes nowhere, and they don't want it to. Now, last election, 1.4 million people more voted Democrat than Republican for the House of Representatives. when we get all the closed bills that we get from the Rules Committee, I want you to realize what that means. That means that half the population in the United States, their representatives, are not going to have amendments. Whatever they may want on the bill, whatever they may want to do, is not going to be considered. You call that democracy? Please, for goodness sake, think about what is happening here. We're going to come back next week, and we're going to take some old bills out of the Judiciary Committee, John, and to try again to humiliate in whatever way they can the President of the United States, to try to insinuate that the man is a lawbreaker. I mean, we have sunk to such a low when it comes to legislation. Yesterday, and I want every last one of you to have a piece of it, we put in the record 50 pieces of legislation crying out for attention. But we do the same thing over and over and over again. It's almost gotten to the point where we could stay home and somebody could just go in a room and put repeat on the record player and have it all over again. It is full of sound and fury, meaning nothing. And they want it that way. It is to stimulate their base, whatever it is. But for goodness sake, every week it's let's destroy the EPA. And I know you've seen this. All regulation is bad, they say. So that all the things that we worked for all these years so that you could breathe clean air, drink clean water, eat safe food, all that means absolutely nothing. And so that's why we're here today. We have got to get the public aroused, that the public knows what is happening here. Nothing. Nothing. And with reasons that I really cannot understand, all of you who are so brilliant, and I read you every day and never take my eyes off the news. I haven't even been able to read a book in 2 years because I have to watch what you guys are doing all the time. Never say a word about it. Not a thing. You may say, most unproductive Congress in history, and off you go on to another direction. Think what the money that is being wasted here week after week to make a political statement is costing us, not just in terms of infrastructure, education, health care, but what it's costing to our self-respect and the way we look to the rest of the people in this world. And so I'm so happy to be here today. I feel really liberated somewhat today that we're saying, we pay attention here. We need everybody to know exactly what's going on here. We're doing our part. We all show up. We go through the motions. But Jefferson's manual is absolutely not a part of what we're doing here. And Abraham Lincoln's adage can be proved again once more. You can fool some of the people all of the time. A strong press paying attention to the government helps us not to be doing that. Thank you very much.
Wow. I think we may dare say that Louise Slaughter gets it. Doesn't surprise me in the least that she does. But I think if you've been in Congress for a while, you must have certain organizing principles about what that Congress is and what it should be doing. And maybe it's taken a few years for some of these folks to realize, as we have asserted time after time on this program, that this country is engaged in a cold civil war. I coined that phrase because I couldn't come up with a different way of making clear. Did you hear Louise Slaughter say, we're getting nothing done and they want it that way? She's got about one more step to take before she actually realizes, I think, and this is not a criticism, this is praise, before she actually realizes that the Republican majority in the House of Representatives are anti-American, anti-government, anti-United States insurgents. This is an insurgency. And I'm really, really grateful to Shorty in L.A. for sending this along, because this tells me that maybe now that the light is beginning to go on and they realize that these are not just people with a somewhat philosophical difference from them, but that rather the Republican majority in the House of Representatives are trying to dismantle the United States of America piece by piece by piece. Maybe this awakening can bear some kind of fruit. And Representative Slaughter is absolutely correct when she says that the press are largely falling down on the job. You reckon that's going to be on the front page of it? No. Hell, it won't even make the front page of Louise Slaughter's hometown newspaper. Our representative, Louise Slaughter, delivers scathing critique of Republicans trying to break the United States into a million tiny pieces. They won't it? No. On the other hand, what will be there? Well, you know. Darlene, with a note, wow. Impressive. Thanks for playing this. Louise Slaughter is hitting it home. Yes. And we damned well need a few more people to do that. We need that light to go on for more members of the Democratic Caucus in the House of Representatives. Because until they understand the nature of their enemy, you know, this is not their dear, you know, that dear friend BS, these are not, the other side are not dear friends or good friends. These are people who are trying to destroy this country as we understand it. They despise gay people. They despise people of color. They despise the poor. They despise women. Hell, they despise veterans. The only people that the Republican majority in the House of Representatives has any respect for are the millionaires and billionaires. And if it goes on very much longer, and there's a distinct possibility that it will, this country will come apart. A few more years of hacking away at food stamps, a few more years of hacking away at social safety net programs, this country will be devolved into something none of us even wants to ponder. Dr. John just sent along a photo that kind of goes with all of this. You know that CPAC is going on. That's the annual Clavern conclave of the right-wingiest of the right-wing in this country. Lunacy. This photograph is of the room in which they were holding their minority outreach panel. CPAC opened today. And while on radio it is not particularly easy to talk about photographs, I think we can do a pretty good job with this. Remember, minority vote outreach panel. In other words, a panel about figuring out how to get people of color and people who are ordinarily not part of the Republican base to lose their minds and go and vote for Republicans. This is a humongous ballroom. That is empty. I'd say not even 10% of the chairs are filled out of what must be 1,000 chairs. If there were 50 people there, it would be surprising to me. I mean, it just, hold on. Yeah, maybe 50. Dr. John noting, I figure there must have been a panel at the same time called How to Slut Shame Working Mothers that really drew off the potential audience for minority outreach vote panel. Thorns in the side. Thorns in the side. And something to talk about perhaps in a little bit later. Yea, verily, glory hallelujah, West Virginia has a chemical storage tank bill that has finally passed the House of Delegates. The legislative session will come to an end, mercifully, on Saturday. The Senate has passed one storage tank bill. The House has passed another. They have to be reconciled in committee, and it has to be fully passed by both houses come, by midnight Saturday. Wow. Isn't that just stunning? We will. We'll talk some more about that later, if you would like to. I should go ahead and mention the phone lines are open, 304-658-3333, if you want to join in the conversation. Let's go to the Skype line. Haven't heard from Jeff in a while. Hey, Jeff.
Hello, Bob. How are you?
I'm a little bit better because I think we saw 55 degrees today.
Well, you know, it's been interesting. I've been in and out of. I've had some health problems, but I've been in and out of hospitals, and all of a sudden I meet my doctor and. He walks around like a pompous ass, by the way, and he's a very capable guy. But I went into the emergency room a couple of times, and there's these people working on me, and it's 2 o'clock in the morning, you know.
By Grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.richmondshow.com.
Corporate lobbyists recently admitted to the New York Times, everybody is embarrassed about it, although not so embarrassed that they don't do it. It is the scandalous copulation between corporate cash and willing legislators that's taking place regularly in such secretive rendezvous resorts as the Dorado Beach Ritz-Carlton. Lawmakers and lobbyists don't like to talk about what they're doing and certainly don't want voters or the media to see them. For these getaways are explicit, tawdry examples of the prostitution of our legislative system. If you had wandered innocently into the Tony Four Seasons Hotel of Vail, Colorado in early January, you could have witnessed one of these group gropes. Assorted lobbyists, including one who represents the utility giant, PPL Corporation, have slipped tens of thousands of dollars into the political pockets of Representative Ed Whitfield and four other House members for the pleasure of rubbing elbows, whining and dining, and whispering sweet legislative nothings to them for hours. At one dinner, the cozy group dug into juicy Wagyu steaks and swilled $60 a bottle wine as they played Scratch My Back Washington-style politics. Whitfield, a Kentucky Republican, was especially popular with the utility lobbyists, for he chairs the House committee that handles legislation affecting, guess who, utilities. And Ed must have had a good time in Vail, because when he returned to Washington, he promptly introduced a bill to let PPL and other electric utilities build additional polluting, coal-burning power plants. An industry favor that would overturn health protections recently approved by the administration. This is Jim Hightowering. Sure, the public approval rating for Congress is at historic lows, but the veiled experience of Whitfield and the others just shows that lawmakers can be lovable. You just have to know the price. Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
Exposing GOP half-truths and hypocrisy every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Rick Smith.
Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@therickSmithShow.com. For our online listeners, for folks listening over at The Horn or at iTunes or TuneIn or any of the other places that we have the program, a little technical difficulty. We're working through it. Apologize. You know, all the new automation stuff, the new computers. You always forget something. There's always a bug that jumps up there and bites you in the behind, and I'm being bitten as we speak. And you know, that was one of the interviews I was really hoping to spend some time on it, but my mind was in two different places. But here, you know, it's scary stuff, and you know, it's something I've talked about often. This idea that technology has gotten so invasive, we have given away so much of our privacy. That, you know, well, I've had people tell me in the Constitution, there's no such word as privacy. There's no privacy. In fact, you know, that back in the old days, that was go to the bathroom. I think the intent is there. To have security in yourself, in your papers, in your home. I think that's pretty implicit. And, you know, we carry around these little tracking devices everywhere we go, and we pay for them. That's the thing that always gets me. I've got this smartphone in my pocket, really smart, that says wherever I am within real time, what I'm doing, where I'm at, and can just, I'm telling you, trust me, they can flip this on, they can hear, see, whatever. The powers to be have this stuff. And, you know, I had someone go, well, how do you know that? I go, well, you know what? You know, when my phone wasn't working so well, they said, oh, well, you know, charge your phone to 100% and we'll jump in. And we'll check it out from our location. Who knows where they are? Some call center in the middle of nowhere. And they're fiddling with my phone. Same thing with your computer. Same thing, you know, with anything. With this TeamViewer stuff, you know, you think they give you the technology that will really... Come on. And what bothers me, and here, look, this is, to bring this back to a worker's perspective, and this is what really bothers me. Right now in this country, we have got an assault on anybody left who's willing to stand up and take a stand. The working people of this country that still have some semblance of say, they're being crushed. And in places where it's already impossible almost to organize, they're making it even more impossible. I look at Mississippi, for instance. Mississippi is a right-to-work state. They have almost no union density whatsoever. They have effectively crushed workers' ability to organize. Now, they have a small percentage. But right now, through their General Assembly, they're pushing... Even further, they're, you know, just like here in Pennsylvania, they want to make organizing, going and talking to your neighbor or talking to coworkers. They want to make that stalking because they want to make it so arduous and so difficult. Nobody ever does it. And that we all just stand in line. And this is where, you know, I've always tried to reach out to my libertarian friends, to my way out right-wing friends. Because I do believe there are things that we can agree on. And you know, over the weekend, we had done I had done a panel at the Keystone Progress Progressive Summit. And I had a number of conversations with folks who were saying, you know, are there issues that, you know, the right and the left and everybody agree? And I go, well, one right now, one of the really big ones is the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement. That's one of the big things I think virtually every working person gets. That more bad free trade policies, not in the best interest of us. In the best interest of the business community, most certainly. Especially the really big global multinational ones. And you go down to some of these privacy issues. To me, this is nonpartisan stuff. This is the kind of stuff that I think we should be in the streets fighting for. So when you see here in Pennsylvania... that you've got a couple of Republicans pitching this idea that, well, let's make organizing stalking. I don't care what side of the political divide you're on. You got to say, whoa, 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 whoa. That's a bridge too far. It's one thing to take the power of our government and use it to block people's ability to do this or that. It's another thing to completely crush the right of association, which last time I checked, it is in the Constitution. And I know like a lot of people like to talk about being constitutional scholars, but at the end of the day, man, you kind of got to look at how things have been going and go, you know, a lot of things are under attack. A lot of things are troublesome. So when I hear, you know, guys like Peter Van Buren talk about this stuff, who, you know, he himself had been through the watchful eye, the assault really of our government on them. And look, I understand. I've always been as distrustful as government as anyone. But I'm equally, if not more, distrustful than corporations, because I still think we can control our government. It's just going to take us to be active, informed, and engaged. And that's where, you know, I've taken some flack for calling Bradley Manning or Chelsea Manning or Snowden, calling them heroes. I've taken some really bizarre emails from people where I go, you know, these are people who sacrificed their lives. Their lives are never going to be the same. They could have easily walked through the next day. They could have easily said, you know what, not my problem. Just going to move right on along. And let it be someone else's problem, and actually be part of the problem. You know, so I look at this and I just go, you know, this is part of being that active, engaged electorate. But then it comes back to just being more than active and engaged. It takes action. It takes getting out in the streets and doing something about it. You know, here a couple weeks ago, the end of January, actually it was, a number of working people from across the state came to the Capitol, because you've got a piece of legislation, House Bill 1507 and Senate Bill 1034. And I talk about this a lot because this poison, this Koch brother poison, this stuff that the billionaires desperately, desperately want in the worst way, is extraordinarily harmful for working people. And it does one very simple thing. It neuters the ability of workers to collectively bring money together to fight their battles, to pay their costs, to pay their unions. And you go, well, you know, that's not such a big deal. It is a big deal. And understand, the wealth class of this country, they've figured this out. They know that if you have to sit down and write out your dues check, chances are you're not going to do it. And this way they can gut their only real political, their real political enemy left. And if they can neuter those resources, if they can gut the ability of workers and their representatives to fight them in the public square, they win. And that's what this is really all about. This, and it may sound, you know, innocuous. It may sound, oh well, you know, the state shouldn't be collecting these dues. Well, first, foremost, it's a negotiated point. The workers gave something up to get that. It's negotiations. And there's part of me that goes, I think we as a society have forgotten that, have forgotten what bargaining is about, have forgotten, or never, maybe we just didn't know what it's like to sit down across from somebody at a table and hammer out an agreement. And you give something, I give something, and at the end of the day, you both walk away ticked off, which I've always been told that both parties walk away and they're not happy, probably a pretty good deal for everybody. Nobody ever gets everything they wanted. But to take this away from the state, and then to take just this one segment, because they're not, you know, Corbett and the Republicans aren't going after stopping banks from deducting car payments, or they're not going after charities from being able to deduct charitable contributions to them. They're not going after any of that. Just at the workers of the state to pay their union dues through a checkoff. And this is the part that is really important here, because Already, right now, as we speak, the law is, if you don't want to pay your dues, if you don't want to be a member of the union, if you don't want to be part of it, you don't have to. And you can have them not take the money out of your check. So what you're basically saying is, you're making it illegal for me to decide to do something that if I wanted to do some the same thing in another venue, perfectly fine. So I can't pay my dues, but I can pay the bank for my car payment. I can pay the bank for my mortgage. I can pay the charity, the church with my money. I can pay Aflac for my disability insurance because the state gets a kickback from that. I can do all that, but not this. This we're going to make illegal. Think about that for a minute. Think about how calculated that is. And think about why. I mean, go back and ask the question why. Why is it that just this one thing, if it's so expensive, because we were told that the reason they have to do this is we're going to save money. Yet when asked how much money, they said they don't know, and that it would probably cost too much to do a study. Telling you that it would be more to do the study than they would save from doing what they want. Does that make any sense to anyone? Am I the only one who thinks that's dumb? I mean, really, think about that for a minute. Think about the power that they're talking about taking and away from these workers and putting into the hands of the likes of Daryl Metcalf and Mike Terzai and Tom Corbett. It's scary stuff, isn't it? And that's why, you know, I think as Peter Van Buren pointed out, we got to start voting some of these people out. Some of the people who've gotten comfortable, get them out for one. And then get people in who, people like you and me. And then use that wonderful thing called term limits. And yeah, we have them. We've got term limits, folks. It's called the right to vote. And if you go out and you vote and you make these people stand in front of you and tell you what they've done, I think we've got a better, I think we've got a shot. Anyway, gonna take a quick break. Right back with the second hour of the program. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Yes, it is all about the children. Even after they're born. Rick Smith. It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. North America's building trades unions oppose President Obama's budget recommendation to privatize the Tennessee Valley Authority. Building trades unions president Sean McGarvey says the unions find the proposal extremely disturbing in light of the Obama administration having consistently praised TVA's efforts in improving its finances while acknowledging the benefits of TVA's public power model. Since TVA gets no taxpayer dollars, McGarvey says the building trades unions failed to understand the logic behind the privatization recommendation. The building trades unions are challenging Obama to present a case as to why this is nothing more than a poorly crafted budget gimmick that won't save money, but will cost jobs. The United Food and Commercial Workers Union is in talks with California's largest grocery store chains for a new labor contract covering some 60,000 workers. The negotiations with Ralph's, Vons, and Albertsons have just gotten started. The union has sent a proposal to the stores. Talks are scheduled for this month and for April. The old contract with the three grocery chains expired March 2nd. Working America is celebrating the election of Santa Fe Mayor Javier Gonzalez. The community affiliate of the AFL-CIO fielded organizers who had 5,000 face-to-face conversations with voters across Santa Fe about why Gonzalez was the best working family candidate on the ballot. Working America's 110,000 members in New Mexico are mobilizing around issues like increasing the minimum wage, getting paid sick days, creating good quality jobs, and improving public education. Working America is a nonprofit organization for people without the benefit of a union on the job. Wisconsin Republicans have removed State Representative Bill Kramer as State Assembly Majority Leader in response to allegations of sexual harassment and assault made against him. But Democrats say that's not enough. Wisconsin Assistant Assembly Democratic Leader Sandy Pash.
Unfortunately, Unfortunately, this reprehensible behavior does not exist in a vacuum. This is a continuation of an established pattern of Wisconsin Republicans' callous treatment of women in our state. Not only did Republicans elevate someone with a well-known history of inappropriate behavior towards women to a leadership role, we've seen the legislature time and time again wage an unprecedented, ideologically driven agenda that allows government to control the decisions of women across our state and severely impact their well-being.
U.S. House Republicans voted Wednesday for the 50th time to delay part of the Affordable Care Act, voting to delay penalties for lacking coverage. Americans United for Change says that would mean leaving an additional million Americans without health insurance. So far, 4 million people have enrolled to get health insurance through the health care reform law. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo wants stronger federal regulations for rail safety, citing frequent train derailments involving transportation of crude oil over the past year. Governor Cuomo is calling on the feds to move swiftly to improve safety and increase the number of rail safety inspections. You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
There was a controversial remark made by a member of your legal team comparing gay marriage to the union of 12-year-olds, saying both are illegal, which you called inappropriate.
It was an inappropriate analogy. You know, I think a much better analogy would have been brother and sister, don't you?
I don't know.
Well, we need to
know. I don't know.
I got to tell you, I love that clip more than anything, because, you know, he started off trying to dig himself out of a hole. And what's that old saying, when you're in a hole, something like stop digging? Because I think, you know, he took a bad situation and only made it much worse for himself, which I'm hoping he does more often here in the coming weeks and months as we look towards November. Anyway, welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind. You can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. So the hilarity, the circus environment of the CPAC conference going on as we speak. And I got to be honest, I wish I could go to those things. I wish they would let me in the door. Because it's hilarity at its best. I can't wait to go home and watch it on TV. But here's the sad thing. And here's the sad reality. The Washington Post just did an article on this the other day that points out that, you know, Democrats got more votes. There are more Democrats. Especially here in Pennsylvania. I mean, there was, I think, 1.5 million more Democratic votes, yet only 5 of the 18 of the congressional delegation are actually Democrats, because the gerrymandering has gotten so bad that they've rigged the game. But here to talk a little bit about how it is that the public actually trusts Democrats more, the public actually wants Democratic policies more, how is it that the conservatives still keep pushing their way to the front of the line? I've got Susie Matrick here. She is the suburban gorilla. Her website, SusieMatrick.com. We've got a link at TheRickSmithShow.com. She's also managing editor over at Crooks and Liars, one of my favorite sites. Susie, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, sure. No problem.
Explain this to me. How is it possible? You know, and I keep beating my head against the wall that there are absolutely more people, more registered Democrats, and more people, you know, leaning Democrat than there are conservatives. How is it that they keep winning elections?
Well, you know, Rick, I hope I don't hurt anybody's feelings when I say this, but voters don't like liberals as people.
Okay, why?
You know, if they have, you know, the sister-in-law who has the master's degree or the,
smarty-pants.
Yeah, they think that liberals are smarty-pants. They think that they're conceited. They think they're condescending, you know, and they just don't like them. And I got to say, they frequently have a point.
No, I'm with you. I mean, I've gone to a number of events where, you know, you get some folks who think that they know everything and know better than you do. It gets a little annoying. But then again, you know, the other side of the spectrum too. You've got the guy in your face, you know, pointing and poking and bullying. I don't see how people are drawn to that really either.
I'll tell you why. Because the other guys are saying, you're a hardworking guy. You're faithful to your wife. You took good care of your kids. You deserve to keep that money. You know, they're coming at them from a positive angle. You know, and I've seen it. I've seen it again and again and again. Every conference that I've ever been to, I bring this up. I see it all the time. Do you remember when Howard Dean was running, and he made a comment that turned out to be very controversial? He said, you know, I don't know why we're not trying to get these guys with the pickup trucks with the shotguns to support universal health care. He said that these people are, they should be in a coalition with us. You know, that these are people we should be going with. Oh, the moaning and the gnashing of teeth from the progressive movement. We don't want anything to do with those people. Those people are racist. Those people are terrible. We don't want to win with people like that. And there we have it in a nutshell. We don't want to win with people like that. This is the progressive blind spot again and again and again. They don't know how to build coalitions, and they don't want to.
No, I mean, as I said, you know, I did a panel over the weekend at the Keystone Progress Progressive Summit, and you know, I said the one thing that the left does masterfully is they build really nice little silos, and then they bomb each other's silos.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. You know, and it just infuriates me because it's like, do you want to win or don't you?
So, you know, how do you change that around? I mean, because I do believe the policies. I do believe the direction. I do believe, and, you know, and while I'm not going to go as far to say this is a Christian nation, but some of the tenets of Christianity I'm in line with when you talk about policy, you know, helping thy neighbor, helping the community, you know, healing the sick, all that stuff. I'm in line with that. How do you move that forward?
Well, this is a problem, isn't it? Because, I see this on Crooks and Liars, that any time we run anything about Pope Francis, who people like.
Yeah,
right?
I'm a huge fan. I'm almost considering going back to the Catholic Church just because of him.
I understand how you feel. I think about it myself. I mean, I'm impressed. I'm waiting to see what happens in America, though.
Yeah, I keep going. He better not let that Pope Mobile get too dusty.
Yeah. Right.
Because he keeps talking about fiddling with the money. I mean, you go back to all the people who said we should be, you know, divvying up some of the cash. They didn't last very long.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But, you know, but there's this thing among a lot of progressive, educated elite who think that anybody who believes in God is stupid. They just flat out think you're stupid. They think you have an inferior intellect.
Do you really believe that that's the mass of the left? I mean, I know.
No, I don't say mass of the left. I'm talking about a lot of the activist types.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I mean, the people who are the ones running, who have the money to run the things.
Right, right. Well, you know, also a lot of the, like, people who staff these places, think tanks and so forth. And, you know, I find it very insulting. And, I can't imagine why, you know, like I live in a white working class neighborhood where people work really hard to save enough money to send their kids to Catholic school. It matters to them, okay? So if they run into somebody who's an alleged liberal who starts making jokes about how the kind of people who believe in a sky god, you know, it's insulting.
Now you've
and
lost
they
them.
Don't, yeah, and they don't care.
See, now I have a whole nother disdain for Catholic school myself. You know,
I went for 12 years.
As a broken Catholic, one who was beaten constantly, made to kneel on hard pees with Bibles out to his side, I have a whole bunch of different animosities and hatreds towards portions of the Catholic Church. But I mean, you know, going back to Pope Francis, I mean, start talking about the things that even they were talking about when I was a kid, peace and social justice and equality and those things. I'm right there with you. This is sign me back up.
Well, that's the other thing, you know, that a lot of the people who are so dismissive, if not outright hostile toward the Catholic Church, don't really know much about it. You know, they know certain things. They know that a lot of priests have been, doing a lot of really horrible things, and that a lot of bishops and cardinals covered that up. And there's no question that that happened. But there's also, they're completely ignorant about the social justice mission of the Catholic Church as well, which is kind of amazing when you consider that if you could build coalitions with them, you would put a lot more power behind what you're trying to do.
Yeah, I mean, labor and the Catholic Church were, you know, when I was a kid growing up, the labor unions and our local Catholic Church, they were tied hand in hand, and they were involved in a lot of things together.
Oh, absolutely. Labor Day parade, the Cardinal would be, right out there in front. So, again, this whole concept that we can't even tolerate, let alone respect, the things that are important to working class people has an awful lot to do with these folks.
Yeah, because I consider myself someone, a sort of on the left. I'm not all the way. I haven't jumped off the cliff yet, but I consider myself leftward. I think that there are policies that we should be moving towards, and I don't consider myself intolerant. I don't consider myself elitist, but I look at some on the right, and I go, do you really? Are those people that you're going to be able to build coalitions with? You look at the CPAC convention going on right now. These are folks who, I don't know. They have a completely different vision of what this country can and should be. How do you bridge that gap with them, or do you?
Well, I don't think you're ever going to bridge it with the kind of people who go to CPAC, because those are the true believers. I mean, I was listening to some of these speeches today, and I was laughing. I was like, God, these people are laughable, and I don't mean that in an elitist way. They contradict themselves.
Yeah.
They're stupid. They're making things up. And, and I'm like, seriously? Like, anybody who is there, who's applauding, who takes this crap seriously, has a screw loose. Or they just want to believe. Like, to them, it's teamwork. They're on our team. We don't really care. We're not going to show any dissent in the ranks. We're gonna join forces and support the team.
Let me ask you.
You don't see that with Democrats.
Yeah, you're right. You don't. You don't see that. And I'm not sure why. Because part of me thinks it's because we've all got our own little thing. And what the right does masterfully is they build silos. But they also understand empire and how to tie them all together and get them marching all in one line. And part of me thinks it's the money. I mean, a lot of money has the effect of doing that, I think.
Yeah, that's part of it. Part of it is also there's something about the liberal temperament. People say that there's a conservative mindset and that, they're authoritarian and that, they feel safer when things are absolute and all this. Well, I think that there are some of these things also in the liberal mindset. And part of it is that when you present anything that's at all new or threatening to them, their immediate reaction is to find one little thing that they can disagree on and dismiss the whole idea because of that one little thing. And I've seen this hundreds, if not thousands of times in the last 10 years.
Yeah, but I thought liberals were supposed to be the ones who were, liberal. They're the ones who are supposed to be more open-minded to this stuff, more. I would expect my conservative friends to be the ones who shy away from anything new. Oh, fire, no, bad.
Well, it's really funny. You hit people in their, their trigger point, and they're just going to lash out at you, and it depends on what that is. But for example, now over Crooks and Liars, we have, like most political websites, we have a largely male readership. It's heavily male readership.
Right.
So we wanted to bring in some more fun stuff, because women tend not to read the hardcore stuff as much, because if you have a family and you're busy, you're not going to do that. So we wanted to throw in like some entertainment stuff, and we got an astrology columnist. Not even like a horoscope. Where you come in and you read and it tells you what's going to happen to you that day.
Right.
Just somebody who writes about astrology and what's going on, and whatever. We stick it on the entertainment page. We don't put it on the front page. We don't make a big deal out of it. We have like this hardcore group of people who go there every single time she writes something and write the nastiest stuff and ridicule her and make fun of her and do all this stuff. And several times, we've gone over in the comments and we've said, seriously, do you know what liberal means?
No.
No,
but I think that's an important thing. I think most people think it's just the opposite of those guys over there.
Exactly. And if you do not have the ability to kind of constantly hold yourself to your own standards, well, you know, I mean, look, we've seen lots and lots of things in the so-called scientific community where people who are outliers in any field are always attacked. It's not a matter of whether you're scientific or logical or not. Outliers are always attacked. Jonas Salk was attacked for his polio vaccine.
As he should have been.
Right.
How dare he save civilization?
You know, but this is what I'm saying. Anybody who goes against anything at all that they consider the conventional wisdom is crazy. Because I'm not crazy and I don't believe in that, so that means you're crazy because you do believe in it. And you see this in so many different fields. And I have a friend who is an investigative reporter for Philadelphia Magazine, and he did a book a couple of years ago. And, what was the name of the book? He started out writing the book because when he was a kid, when he was like 5 years old, his family lived in a haunted house. And he was, this one night where all of the kids are like huddled in bed, pulling the covers over them, because there's this pounding on the roof that went on, you know, like for hours, and they didn't know what caused it. So this guy, investigative reporter, common sense guy, but he, you know, unfortunately for him, he's open-minded. So he writes this book called Fringeology. And it was how I tried to explain away the unexplainable and couldn't. And he looks at several different things. There was a town in Texas that had a lot of UFO activity one summer. He talked to a scientist at University of Penn who specialized in monitoring brain activity during prayer. A lot of unusual phenomena that they couldn't really find an explanation for. And what he said was, the one thing that all these things have in common is that there's a certain mindset that can't accept that some things are unknowable with our current knowledge.
Yeah.
And that it's not enough to just say, I don't know what happened with that. You have to attack the people who bring it up. And, man, the people that I know like that are much more likely to be liberal.
Interesting. Because you know, I have to think that through. Because part of me, and going back to the CPAC thing, the people in those rooms, and really a lot of, I guess the people who go to any of those political type conferences, they tend to see it as sport mentality. I think a lot of the times.
Oh yeah. And there's
part of me that looks at this whole thing is just a game. The people up on the stage know it's a game, and they're performing. Doing this program, I get to go to a lot of these talkers events, and you know, you meet these other talk show hosts who, when you talk to them individually, they don't seem insane. But you get them behind a mic and they're off the beaten path because they're playing the game.
And the thing with them is that they consciously play the game. That everybody's in on the joke. You know what I mean?
And that's what frightens me, that you know, that there are people who know that this is a game. We're playing this, but the people who are the true believers, they don't realize they're part of the game.
Well, this is one of the things that I talk about when I'm on the radio a lot, which is that you know, when people get upset about, you know, gay marriage, and I say, you know, here's the thing. If you know people who work in D.C., you know, people who live in D.C., then you know a couple of things. One is that a very large percentage of Capitol Hill staffers are gay.
Yep.
And an awful lot of them. I dare say every openly homophobic senator or congressman has openly gay staffers. And this is because these congressmen and these senators don't really care. They're playing a game, and this is what I tell people. You're being used. You're being manipulated. They don't care about this. This is something that just gets them more money in the fundraisers.
And I wish people would get that. The shiny thing is never what they care about, especially when you talk about politicians. Most politicians, it's just a popularity contest. They want the votes. I don't think, I think very few of them have, and you can disagree, but I think very few of them have really, really hardcore belief structures.
I agree. I think that their hardcore belief is, I believe I really want to get reelected.
Exactly.
And I'll do whatever I have to do to make that happen. But, you know, we have these issues, these social issues that are so clearly used to distract us from real issues. Like, for example, like one of the things I've been talking about for years is if I ever had the time and the money, and I never had the time, I would love to start an advocacy organization that only focused on two things: getting monopoly hearings in Congress for the cable and the cell carrier industry.
Yes.
Just those two things. And people say to me, because this is how progressives think, right? What did I say before when somebody comes up with an idea?
Well, no, I'm with you. I think it's a great idea. Let's start that.
Let's talk about the usual response. The usual response was, well, I don't see what good that would do for Democrats. And I say, okay, here's what it would do. What it would do is it would draw a huge number of people on a bipartisan basis who would learn through this effort exactly how corrupt this system is and who the real enemies are. I think that's useful, don't you? And they just kind of go, I don't know. I don't see it.
Wow.
You were talking about silos. One of the problems in progressive circles is that so many people only see it through their issue. Like, oh, I'm an LGBT activist. That doesn't do anything for us, so we don't care about that. Or I'm a women's rights activist. I'm a reproductive health activist. That doesn't have anything to do with us. See, and I look at it from cutting off the snake at the head. You know, because the massive amounts of money that's poured in by the telecom industry that controls Congress,
yep,
you know, which is huge.
No, I'm with you. And I would throw internet people in there as well, because I'd like to know why where I live I have worse internet service than most third world nations.
This is something that we wrote about today. I don't know if you saw our story. What, you know, why is the United States
like Estonia?
Yes, right. And it's true. And it's because we, with complete corporate capture, this is another one of the things that I have said to these people, you know, when I've tried to push this idea. Do you understand that for most working people, other than their mortgage or their car payments, the cable is the single biggest bill they have?
Yep.
And they go, oh, really? Like, you know what I mean? I guess they just don't know any people like that anymore.
And part of me thinks it's because we don't talk to each other anymore. We've been told we're individuals and shoved to the sides. And what I find interesting about the right is they preach individualism and actually do some pretty good jobs of acting collectively, as where the left preaches about collective action but only does things individually.
Right. And, you know, I just think that, I do know some great progressive activists who are like totally in sync with all this stuff and incredibly sensitive to it and have no problem talking to anybody. And then I know other activists who, when you bring up certain things, you know, and certain activities or actions that you suggest, and you sort of get the idea that they don't want to be around any kind of icky working people.
Yeah.
Like, that's icky.
Yeah. So let me ask you, last question then. You know, how do you change this? I mean, how do we, because look, the ideas, the policies, the thoughts, I still think a working class agenda is what the mainstream of America really wants. Good schools for their kids, safe neighborhoods, some retirement security, good working conditions, good jobs, good wages, all of that stuff. How do we get people on the same page moving towards that?
We need to stop digressing. We need to stop being, we need to stop looking for our differences. I think we need to concentrate on learning how to build coalitions. I think it's something we need to hammer home again and again and again. Like, I don't care. You know, like, look at Alan Grayson, who will go and work with Ron Paul or rather Rand Paul, on getting an audit of the Fed. He got it done.
Yeah.
I know progressives who think that that was awful because, after all, he made common cause and gave credibility to Rand Paul. I don't feel that way.
No, I don't care. Just do the work.
Well, that's it. That's it. I think that a lot of progressives, because they all sort of come through these same kinds of training programs and so forth, they're very focused on doing and saying the correct thing rather than doing what works. And what I say is that we need to see more working people involved in these moves. I'll tell you right now, I mean, I've been doing this for 10 years, and when I see jobs being passed around, you know, for various progressive groups, they always start with must-have college degree. So right there, how many people have you blocked out of it?
Yeah, good point.
How many diverse voices are lost with these kind of requirements?
Especially people who work for a living. Who've started off, you know, the people who work with their hands, the people who maybe
right.
weren't fortunate enough to be able to go to college. Interesting.
Right. So, you know, so my feeling is I would like to see more working people start their own progressive organizations and show them how it's done.
Yeah, but here's the thing. I mean, who's got the time? I mean, you look at this stuff, mm-hmm. and the problem is we've been on this treadmill.
Yeah.
You've got people who are just, you know, they're taxed out already. And, you know,
yeah.
as you look
yeah.
at this, you know, it comes down to you got to get food on the table. You got to keep the roof over the head. It's a tough gig.
If nothing else, we need to start telling our young people to at least consider this path. When they're looking for something to do, why shouldn't they go to labor college and become a labor organizer?
Yep, I'm with you. Absolutely. And, people, I got chastised over the weekend for bringing my daughter to the summit by some of my friends. Oh, you're brainwashing your kid. No, I'm giving her a well-rounded education, giving her equal opportunity to see a number of different things and to choose her path.
Yes, of course.
But that's, you know, I guess just too much for some. But, Susie, it's always great talking with you. We ran a little longer than I had planned, but it's always interesting and always informative when I get a chance to talk with you. I'd love to have you come back again more often.
Okay. All right, Rick. Good talking to you.
Thanks so much, Susie. Susie Madrick, she's the Suburban Gorilla. SusieMadrick.com, the website. We've got a link at TheRickSmithShow.com. Also managing editor over at Crooks and Liars. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
This is the Media Matters Minute, and I'm John Kerr. Representative Paul Ryan, chairman of the House Budget Committee, helped kick off the Conservative Political Action Conference with a speech that dismissed the importance of programs for low-income Americans. He implied that low-income parents don't care for their children if they can't afford to send their kids to school with brown bag lunches.
He once met a young boy from a very poor family, and every day at school, he would get a free lunch from a government program. He told Eloise he didn't want a free lunch. He wanted his own lunch, one in a brown paper bag, just like the other kids. He wanted one, he said, because he knew a kid with a brown paper bag had someone who cared for him.
On Fox's Happening Now, correspondent Carl Cameron, reporting from CPAC, characterized Ryan's speech as taking a middle-of-the-road tone. Ryan's dismissal of school lunch programs ignores the 3.9 million children in America who were food insecure in 2012 and 15.9 million who lived in food insecure households, according to the USDA. For more on this and other stories, please visit MediaMatters.org.
A corporate lobbyist recently admitted to the New York Times, everybody is embarrassed about it, although not so embarrassed that they don't do it. It is the scandalous copulation between corporate cash and willing legislators that's taking place regularly in such secretive rendezvous resorts as the Dorado Beach Ritz-Carlton. Lawmakers and lobbyists don't like to talk about what they're doing and certainly don't want voters or the media to see them, for these getaways are explicit, tawdry examples of the prostitution of our legislative system. if you had wandered innocently into the Tony Four Seasons Hotel of Vail, Colorado in early January, you could have witnessed one of these group gropes. Assorted lobbyists, including one who represents the utility giant, PPL Corporation, had slipped tens of thousands of dollars into the political pockets of Representative Ed Whitfield and four other House members for the pleasure of rubbing elbows.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. So, Staples. Remember Staples was going to take over the, we were going to put postal offices in the Staples? And, you know, there was some people going, oh, it's a great idea, let's put Staples in the post office. It's a great idea, Staples in the post office. Or, I mean, the post office in Staples, what are they talking about? And, you know, I said, you know, that's probably not a great idea, do you think? And I had a couple of folks say, well, not a bad idea. You know, I go to Staples kind of every once in a while. And, you know, while I get my toner and my paper and my, you know, little glue sticks, maybe I'll buy a stamp. And I said, you know, I don't know. You know, again, it's like any business, you know, the winds of going out of business, closing down, you know. I said, yeah, I think the post office finds where they're at. In fact, the post office are in neighborhoods that maybe a lot of Staples aren't. And it might actually, you know, do some good for the community, might actually help folks, you know, just a thought. I see this story today. In fact, today Staples announced that they were going to be closing more than 200 brick-and-mortar stores here in the U.S. and in Canada. And they're going to, you know, they're going to push more towards the online stuff. They're going to push more towards the Amazon model, I guess, because Amazon's killing everybody. Their overall sales fell to about $6 billion at the end of 2013, about 4%, according to their fourth quarter investors report. So, you know, you look at this and you go, okay, we were going to put the post office and the Staples. Now you're going to close a bunch of Staples. What happened to the post office? And these are those things that you got to think down the road. It may sound like a great idea today, but what about 6 months? What about a year? What about two? They just announced within the last couple of months that they were going to start putting these little post offices in these Staples. And now you're seeing them starting to close the stores. Evidently, by the end of 2015, they're going to close, I guess, 225 of them is the number. To me, again, this is more of that privatization scheme, more of the ripoff of the commons, if you will, of our stuff. And we just kind of blindly, passively just kind of accept it. It's, well, I just think it's a horrible idea, don't you? I mean, on some level, we've been, again, sold down the wrong path. Now, on the Postal Service front, we should be strengthening it. I like the idea that Elizabeth Warren came out with, the idea of maybe having the Postal Service do some small loans, get the loan sharks out of it, get the payday lenders out of it. Don't let payday lenders into Pennsylvania. Have the post office do it. Sounds reasonable to me. Sounds rational. And you know what? I'm pretty sure that post office will be around tomorrow. Unlike the Staples. Anyway, let's take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show.
Corporate lobbyists recently admitted to the New York Times, everybody is embarrassed about it, although not so embarrassed that they don't do it. It is the scandalous copulation between corporate cash and willing legislators that's taking place regularly in such secretive rendezvous resorts as the Dorado Beach Ritz-Carlton. Lawmakers and lobbyists don't like to talk about what they're doing and certainly don't want voters or the media to see them. For these getaways are explicit, tawdry examples of the prostitution of our legislative system. If you had wandered innocently into the Tony Four Seasons Hotel of Vail, Colorado in early January, you could have witnessed one of these group gropes. Assorted lobbyists, including one who represents the utility giant, PPL Corporation, had slipped tens of thousands of dollars into the political pockets of Representative Ed Whitfield and four other House members for the pleasure of rubbing elbows, wining and dining, and whispering sweet legislative nothings to them for hours. At one dinner, the cozy group dug into juicy Wagyu steaks and swilled $60 a bottle wine as they played scratch-my-back Washington-style politics. Whitfield, a Kentucky Republican, was especially popular with the utility lobbyists, for he chairs the House committee that handles legislation affecting, guess who, utilities. And Ed must have had a good time in Vail, because when he returned to Washington, he promptly introduced a bill to let PPL and other electric utilities build additional polluting, coal-burning power plants, an industry favor that would overturn health protections recently approved by the Obama administration. This is Jim Hightower saying, sure, the public approval rating for Congress is at historic lows, but the Vail experience of Whitfield and the others just shows that lawmakers can be lovable. You just have to know the price. Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
Standing up to conservatives and corporatists every weeknight, The Rick Smith Show.
So now you see the light, hey, stand up for your rights. Come on, get up, stand up, stand up for your rights.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick, at TheRickSmithShow.com. So you may remember, a couple of weeks ago, we talked to a couple of pork truck drivers down in Georgia, who were, according to the reports, were working like 60 hours a week, making like $9 an hour, working for these companies as independent contractors. Somehow that, you know, they've jerry-rigged these contracts to make, of course, the folks at the very bottom responsible for all of the heavy lifting. And I just thought, you know, completely outrageous, which is why I've spent a bunch of time over the last couple of months talking about it, because I think it's an extraordinary, it's one of the most important issues for workers right now, this misclassification that's going on, not just in the trucking industry, but across the work spectrum, which is why we've asked Ben Spate, organizing director for Teamsters Local 729, to come talk to us. Ben, thanks for taking time for us.
Absolutely, Rick. It's good to be with you.
You know, I look at this, and, you know, I had the opportunity to talk to a couple of the drivers who are part of this this campaign to get people properly classified. And the stories that they tell are just, I mean, on one vein, heartbreaking, but on the other side, just maddening.
Well, I think if you look at it, what we're dealing with in Savannah, Georgia, we have several thousand workers, port truck drivers there at the Port of Savannah that is a massive economic engine for this region, and for the entire country, really. It's the fourth most busiest port in the United States. And, these drivers come from an industry that, you know, prior to 1980, they were employees. You know, the trucking companies hired them as employees, and as such, they had all the rights of employees, from workers' comp to unemployment, and obviously the right to organize. And since deregulation in 1980, I mean, the bottoms fell out. And what we see, you know, with misclassification is that an employer calls you an independent contractor, well, you know, then it's your burden to prove them otherwise, when it should be the other way. The employer should treat you as a worker and give you workers' rights, without you having to, you know, sue them or wage a mighty struggle like what the Teamsters are engaged in Savannah and Los Angeles, Seattle, New Jersey, and elsewhere, to try to, you know, push for legislation, to reverse this and to get some labor law enforcement to say, that, you know, these workers deserve basic labor protections. That's what we're fighting for, Rick.
So help walk me through this, because, you know, I go back to, you know, my grandfather during, you know, came back from the war, World War II, learned to drive a truck, made a decent living as a teamster for a number of years. I was able to make a decent living for more than 20 years, carrying a teamster's car, driving a truck. You know, how did that go wrong? I mean, you know, they were made to be good, solid, middle-class kind of jobs that you could support a family on. When did this really start to go south, where I'm looking at people making $9 an hour driving an 80,000-pound vehicle up and down the roads? That, to me, is insane.
Well, I mean, it's you know, when you talk about removing government regulations over industries like, you know, the trucking industry, you leave it, you know, the law of the jungle. And the victims have been the people that do the work every day. And, you know, in this case, thousands of port drivers and ports all across this country, I tell you. There's probably no point in our entire economy that is more important to everything else than where the ports of entry, the seaports. And these drivers should be making a decent living because they're doing very important work for all of us. But, in fact, you know, the wages in Savannah are below $9 an hour, and what we're working, you know, trying to prove with the U.S. Department of Labor in Savannah is to show that these workers actually make below the minimum wage of $7.25 an hour. When you account for how much they have to pay out of pocket for it, you know, from, you know, expenses from tires to fuel, and in many cases, they lease the trucks from the trucking companies that are making trucking payments on their trucks as well.
Yeah, that's the most perverse part of all this. That, you know, the companies have done a masterful job of shifting the responsibilities onto the people who are least able to shoulder them. And I've had a couple of people go, well, you know, Rick, well, why do they take the jobs? Why do they do it? And, you know, it's one of those questions that, you know, the people who have bloated self-images of themselves, that I would just go somewhere else. How do you answer that to them? How do you answer that you took the job? Just, you know, lump it.
Well, the answer is, as I was raised and as many people were taught, is that you go out, you know, if you're come from a working family, you go out there and you get a skill. You learn a craft. And in this case, going out and getting a commercial driver's license is a skilled job. I mean, it's a job where have your life in your hands and other people's lives in your hands. And when you're, working less than paycheck to paycheck, bringing home $200 a week, you don't really have a whole lot of money to keep, you know, up the best quality truck out there on the road.
Sure.
You know, you're working long hours, stressed out. So it's a public safety hazard, and that's one thing that the Big Rig Overhaul report pointed out, and that the previous report pointed out, is that there's broad impacts in the community that go beyond just the port drivers and their family, which are many. But the community is impacted by it too. So the person says that you should just hop over, you know, to the other side and get you another job. Well, you know, these folks have been sold the dream of going into business for yourself and being your own boss. And that's the whole mythology around owning your own truck, is that you can go out there and, you know, start up your own business, call it, you know, Rick's Trucking Company, and you can, you know, haul some containers. And, you know, that's what these drivers are told that they're going to be doing. And, in fact, they sign exclusive haul agreements with these trucking companies that require them, in many cases, in these lease agreements, to haul exclusively for these trucking companies, where they're not like a contractor, a plumbing contractor, or, you know, a housing contractor that can pick what jobs they do and charge their rates. In fact, the trucking companies dictate to them what their rates are, and it's a total form of exploitation, and we often refer to it as sharecroppers on wheels, because in fact these workers are paying for the right to work, and we're seeing it in a lot of different industries. And construction has eaten up with it, and you know, the building trades have been fighting this for many years, and we're seeing it also in the production industry. IOTC is fighting this in Georgia and elsewhere, and that's where we're seeing movements in multiple states to rein this thing in. And I'll tell you, there's another side to it that is not just about justice for workers, but states are looking at this issue because it's a revenue problem.
Right.
Even in very conservative states like Georgia, the Georgia Department of Labor currently owes $1 billion to the federal government because Georgia's legislature had passed several years of an unemployment tax holiday that drained the reserves. So when the financial crisis hit, obviously Georgia workers were laid off and out of work. And so there's a $1 billion deficit to the federal government. And instead of attacking unemployment benefits for Georgia workers as they're doing, they should be looking at trucking companies and saying, you should pay your fair share. These trucking companies aren't paying it to the unemployment tax system.
Yeah, that's an important,
they should be.
That's an important point to bring up. The fact that, you know, you've moved the responsibility for these, for unemployment, for workers' comp, for a whole bunch of things off of the corporate rolls and onto the backs of the employees, and then not at all. So then the state ends up getting shortchanged, and the entire community gets shortchanged. And, you know, going back to the answer that, you know, that I've given for why not go across the street and find another job is when you have these bad actors, when you have folks who are doing these things, misclassifying employees, cheating the system, cheating their workers, it's an entire culture. And, you know, it's not easy just to go across the street because the guy across the street, in order to keep up with the guy who you're leaving, he's got to do the same thing. So we've got this spiraling downward of one bad actor pulling everyone down, even if everybody else wants to do the right thing. In order to compete, they almost have to. Even if they don't want to, they almost have to just to compete.
Well, I mean, Rick, I'm inspired by people like you had on last week, Carol Colley, who's a mother and a hard worker.
Yep.
And dealing with all kinds of, you know, mistreatment out there just to try to raise her family. And, you know, if there was other trucking jobs available, she'd be on it. You know, if you go out and you work for another outfit, unfortunately in the trucking industry, you have a hard time, you know, ultimately making it work over a number of years, you know, having good benefits, having a voice on the job, having safety on the job. But I'm very proud of these workers in Savannah that are joining with, for the first time, port drivers in other cities. And in Los Angeles is a very advanced organizing campaign that the Teamsters are leading that is bringing together both misclassified drivers and employee drivers together to push forward and try to change the Port of Los Angeles and Long Beach. And obviously they're dealing with a very different political climate, but they've gotten the California Department of Labor over there to really go after some of these trucking companies that are intentionally misclassifying workers and denying them their basic rights. As you know, and I'm sure you've reported on your program, there was a strike last fall in Los Angeles, and the workers are taking a stand there. Earlier this week in Vancouver, Canada, port truck drivers went on strike as well, and they were joined by the newly formed Canadian Auto Workers Union that merged with another union there in Canada. And there's union workers and misclassified workers up there that are coming together. So there's a lot of examples of this. The taxi cab industry, the chauffeur's industry is also another example of it. There's a number of industries that are impacted by misclassification, and I think it's an example of how you just race to the bottom where corporations and even small trucking companies and other firms are looking for ways to make labor contingent and easily exploitable in the gray areas of the law, and to both exploit loopholes in government regulations around their own tax requirements, avoiding unemployment tax, Social Security tax, workers' comp. But you can also see it in the use in the manufacturing sector of temporary workers. And we're seeing that in both warehouse and manufacturing. Here in Georgia, just outside of Atlanta, the Glock gun manufacturer employs a majority of temporary workers over years. These are perma temps, people that work for years without any rights, without any voice, without the right to organize a union. And we're seeing this really proliferation of it. If you're classified as a temp, they can't count you as a manufacturing worker. And so we're seeing this whole use of workers and classifying them that it makes them easy to be exploited on the job. But the encouraging sign is that you see unions like the Teamsters Union that I belong to, obviously, and I work for as an organizer here in Georgia, that are looking at these workers and saying, we're going to have to find a way. These workers deserve a voice on the job. They deserve justice. And we're going to find a way, even if that means they're not immediately members of our union. We're going to help them build campaigns, even in difficult places like here in Georgia, where we can move forward legislation and we can begin to try to change the labor law enforcement in our state. And just this past week, two state senators co-sponsored two separate bills around employee misclassification in Georgia. And I tell you, Rick, it's been a long time since labor or other progressive allies who are advocating for working folks have been able to introduce legislation. Now, that legislation will be brought up again next year, and we're going to continue to fight for it. But it's important for us to move forward a positive agenda.
Yep.
And get these folks engaged in their own issues. And I think we've achieved that in our organizing. We're going to keep on doing it.
Yeah, I mean, that's to me, that's what's got to happen all across the country. And, you know, I look at the broken nature of our labor laws in this country, and I've been saying for years that, you know, most of our labor laws are 50 years old and need to be looked at again, especially this misclassification stuff. The 1099 employees, you know, at some point, we've got to be, as a society, say, this isn't what we want. This idea of permanent temps, these third party logistic companies who usurp abilities to organize, all of these things have to be looked at and reevaluated and I think changed.
I think they have to be fundamentally changed, and I think that we have to just it's not even breaking away from things that and our values that we know are true. We fought, and everything about our country, everything that makes our country great, is that we have constantly fought to expand mm-hmm. rights to more people, is to expand rights to more people and to ensure that nobody's left out of rights and that there shouldn't be a worker. There shouldn't be a parenthesis around workers' rights except for these people, except for people that are classified as independent contractors, except for people that are temps, except for agricultural workers or housekeepers, you know, except for people that are undocumented or except for these people. And as long as we have that in our labor market, we're going to have a bottom. And as long as we allow that bottom not to have any floor, there's always going to be pressure in competition in the labor market that's going to drive down wages.
Yeah.
We can't say that we're going to have poverty wages if you work. Because if you accept poverty wages on that end, there's going to be pressure on you when it comes up for a raise. So, you know, we're all tied up in it, Rick, and I'm glad that, you know, that there's a lot of organizing going on, and I'm glad there's a lot of attempts to build, you know, build up our unions through organizing. You know, I look at the Volkswagen election and I say, you know what, we lose some and we win some and we learn from our losses and we get better. And there's a lot of good positive examples of organizing in the South, and the port work we're doing in Savannah I really do believe is part of that, but there's a lot more work to be done. And I think that if you look at this issue that the Teamsters are raising around employee misclassification, we can begin to see that we can move legislation, we can organize workers on the ground, we can, as in the total organizing victory in the collective bargaining contract the Teamsters negotiated in California and are in the process of negotiating in New Jersey, you know, make some really positive advancements and get our toll hold in there while we build a bigger base.
Yeah, I'm
so
with you.
I think at the end of the day, the story is positive for us all.
And then to me, any organizing, any movement towards, you know, telling the story and getting people's stories out, because you're right, Ms. Colley's story was extraordinarily powerful. I got numerous responses from people going, I can't believe it. How does that happen in this country that, you know, someone gets put in that position? And, you know, I'm of the mindset the more we hear about it, the more we identify with each other, the more we're willing to, I think, come together and say no more.
Well, I want to thank you, I mean, Rick, and just to take this chance to say, I work with the little community radio station here in Atlanta, but it's great to have a program like yours that can reach to so many people and that we can come together in this space. because I wish I could invite y'all and, you know, some, many of your listeners to our union meetings, or organizing meetings, but the most important thing is that we get information out to people and then they apply it in their own communities, their own workplaces, and get to work, you know. I mean, it's just about getting folks together and talking about what's impacting us to coming up with a plan.
That's it.
And people like Carol, you know, she's already a survivor and a powerhouse there at the port. You have to be a, you know, a driver in general, and to be a woman out there in such a tough environment. She's overcome everything to really be a great leader amongst so many of these drivers out there. And, you know, we just talked to them tonight. We had a conference call with the organizing committee, and, you know, these are just average people. And the listeners that you work with, you know, that are tuning in are either come out of the labor movement or working people themselves. And, you know, at the end of the day, when you talk to somebody like Carol Caller, like you did last week, you were talking truck driver to truck driver, and it came out, and that's what made it so powerful, and she definitely felt good after she was on your program. So I definitely want to thank you for that, Rick, and for giving, you know, these organizing stories an opportunity to be heard.
I think they're important. I think because I think people need to know that there are others out there. There are folks who are willing to stand with them. And once we can start building that community of people who believe that there's someone out there to help them, I think good things can happen. Last question I've got for you: What can we do to help? What's the marching order? What's the action for our listeners? What can we do?
Well, I think in particular with our campaign, you know, there's going to be opportunities to get involved. One of the companies that has been really trying to fight the workers who have been organizing both misclassified and employee drivers is a company called Green Fleet Systems that hauls a lot for Skechers shoes. And so there's been flyering that we have done at Skechers shoe retail outlets to try to expose their connection. Again, it's like, you know, just the typical story of a corporation saying we don't have any responsibility for our contract workers. Just because they drive for this company, Green Fleet, we're not going to take any responsibility for them. And there's going to be continued opportunities like that, because as you look at these trucking companies, who are they hauling for? I mean, for instance, there's trucking companies in Savannah, Georgia that haul for Target or haul for Home Depot. And this is, it's also important that these kind of companies, these retail companies that we deal with as consumers, hear from us and say, it's time for you to intervene.
Absolutely.
On the actions of those that supply these goods.
So it's going to be us putting pressure on them. Ben, it's always great talking with you. I appreciate the time. Thanks so much. I'll take
a
quick break back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better. It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. North America's building trades unions oppose President Obama's budget recommendation to privatize the Tennessee Valley Authority. Building trades unions President Sean McGarvey says the unions find the proposal extremely disturbing in light of the Obama administration having consistently praised TVA's efforts in improving its finances while acknowledging the benefits of TVA's public power model. Since TVA gets no taxpayer dollars, McGarvey says the building trades unions fail to understand the logic behind the privatization recommendation. The building trades unions are challenging Obama to present a case as to why this is nothing more than a poorly crafted budget gimmick that won't save money, but will cost jobs. The United Food and Commercial Workers Union is in talks with California's largest grocery store chains for a new labor contract covering some 60,000 workers. The negotiations with Ralph's, Vaughn's, and Albertsons have just gotten started. The union has sent a proposal to the stores. Talks are scheduled for this month and for April. The old contract with the three grocery chains expired March 2nd. Working America is celebrating the election of Santa Fe Mayor Javier Gonzalez. The community affiliate of the AFL-CIO fielded organizers who had 5,000 face-to-face conversations with voters across Santa Fe about why Gonzalez was the best working family candidate on the ballot. Working America's 110,000 members in New Mexico are mobilizing around issues like increasing the minimum wage, getting paid sick days, creating good quality jobs, and improving public education. Working America is a nonprofit organization for people without the benefit of a union on the job.
Wisconsin Republicans have removed State Representative Bill Kramer as State Assembly Majority Leader in response to allegations of sexual harassment and assault made against him. The Democrats say that's not enough. Wisconsin Assistant Assembly Democratic Leader Sandy Pasch.
Unfortunately, this reprehensible behavior does not exist in a vacuum. This is a continuation of an established pattern of Wisconsin Republicans' callous treatment of women in our state. Not only did Republicans elevate someone with a well-known history of inappropriate behavior towards women to a leadership role, we've seen the legislature time and time again wage an unprecedented, ideologically driven agenda that allows government to control the decisions of women across our state and severely impact their well-being.
U.S. House Republicans voted Wednesday for the 50th time to delay part of the Affordable Care Act, voting to delay penalties for lacking coverage. Americans United for Change says that would mean leaving an additional million Americans without health insurance. So far, 4 million people have enrolled to get health insurance through the health care reform law. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo wants stronger federal regulations for rail safety, citing frequent train derailments involving transportation of crude oil over the past year. Governor Cuomo is calling on the feds to move swiftly to improve safety and increase the number of rail safety inspections.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Minimum wage!
You know what it means when they pay you minimum wage? You know what they're trying to tell you? It's like, hey, if I could pay you less, I would.
1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick, at therickssmithshow.com. So you may remember last month, the Congressional Budget Office came out and said, well, you know, if we raise the minimum wage, there might possibly be some job loss. And the right wing went ballistic. Oh, Obama wants to kill the jobs. Obama wants to go after the job creators. Oh, he hates job creators. He hates them. And like I talked about yesterday, you know, Bloomberg, not, you know, Bloomberg News, not the most, you know, fancy pants liberal, you know, news agency. They pointed out in the 15 years since Washington State increased their minimum wage to the highest in the nation at $9.32 an hour, their growth continued at an average of 0.8% annual pace, which is 0.3% above the national average. And they pointed out that, you know, in the areas where we were told the jobs would be lost, which are in restaurants and bars, and, you know, all the waitresses are going to lose their jobs, and the bartender is going to be, you know, he's going to be out on the street corner with a bottle of his own. What actually happened in Washington State was that employment in those job markets actually expanded by 21%. And the poverty rates in Washington trailed the rest of the U.S. For at least 7 years. Now, this is Bloomberg reporting this. And you know, you look at this, and I've been saying for a while, you want to stimulate the economy, you get people to be able to share in some of the wealth that they create. Either through unionizing, either through laws that encourage, that raise the minimum wage, and then bump everybody else up just a little touch. Put a little couple of bucks into everybody's pocket, they're going to spend it. What I find interesting, you know, when Bush went around and said, oh, we're going to go and give $500 away, or we're going to send you $300, everyone was jumping for joy. Oh, the president's giving us money back. Oh, the Republicans love us. Where's my Bush prize? And I remember people who couldn't wait to get their Bush money. Running to the post office. Oh, I'm going to go to the post office. And they open up the mailbox. Oh, my Bush prize. Yay. Do you remember what you did with your Bush prize? Do you remember what you did with the $500 or the $300? Do you remember? Because I remembered at the time I had a mortgage. And I remember putting it on the mortgage. And that's, you know, my wife and I talked about it. We just took the money, the extra money went on the mortgage. We didn't actually buy anything new. There was no new consumption, and we know that. Now, when you give somebody an extra $20 a week, an extra $25 a week, they're going to spend that. You gave me $500, I'm like, hey, I can make an extra mortgage payment. You give someone an extra $20, you're not going to make an extra mortgage payment. You're probably going to spend that. Which is why I found it interesting that a group called the Small Business Majority, they released a new poll that said nearly 6 out of 10 small business owners were in favor of raising the minimum wage up to $10.10 an hour. In fact, nearly 3 in 10 were strongly in support of the idea. Interestingly enough, the quote-unquote entrepreneurs who were polled for this, predominantly Republican. 47% of them self-identified as Republican or Republican-leaning, compared to just 35% of folks who identified themselves as leaning Democrat. It also points out that two-thirds of the businesses polled had less than $1 million in revenue in 2013. 59% of the businesses were older than 50 years old. I mean, these are folks who, not big business, not huge business by any stretch of the imagination. So when we're talking about small business, we're talking about people like me. We're talking about people who, you know, they're just trying to make ends meet. Talking about the guy who has 4 or 5 employees. We're not talking about Halliburton. We're not talking about people with streams of, we're not talking about McDonald's. But I find it interesting that there are folks who say, well, you know, we should be raising the minimum wage because it's going to help business. Yes, it's going to help business. And these business owners know that. They are the ones who see their customers every day. They're the ones who go, you know, I would like to have some more customers walk in my door. What's the best way of getting customers to come in my door? Huh. Let me think about that. Money in their pocket. Yeah, money in their pocket would probably be a good reason that customers would come in the door, other than if you had something to sell. And if you've got junk, nobody's going to come in the door. But if you've got decent stuff and people, something people want, money in the pocket generally is the number one reason they don't buy. So what's the best thing for small business? Money in the pocket. Put a couple of bucks in people's pocket, they're going to spend it. And I look at this story with our governor. Now, the governor's not going to take the Medicaid expansion money because that's going to create some 40,000 jobs and make sure that people get some form of health care. But he is taking, and this is one of those things that you know, kind of had me, I stopped for a second and I go, okay, well, other than it's an election year, and it is, it's an election year. Corbett has decided that he's going to change some the calculation and spend a little extra money on the LIHEAP program. In fact, I guess he's going to spend another $8 million on the LIHEAP program, the Low Income Heating Assistance Program, so that the state will get to keep about $300 million in food stamps that will go out to people who need it. Because part of the farm bill, and if you remember all of the shenanigans and the nonsense that went around that, they cut a percentage of the SNAP benefits. And I think it was something like 1% of, and you go, wow, it's just 1%? 1%'s not going to hurt anything? 1%'s $300 million. So he takes this, and this is one of those things, it's interesting. And weird on how the Republicans and how they came up with this new calculation. What is going to happen? What has happened in the past, I understand, is in order to get a little bit higher SNAP benefit, you would receive something like, you know, like a buck from LIHEAP. Or, you know, you get this dollar and you get a little bit extra because one program ties on to another. And it's weird how they make these things up. Under this program, and this is one of those things, because of the changes in the farm bill, the average family could lose about $90 a month. Unless the states raise the payments for LIHEAP to a new threshold of $20, which that's where Corbett's money comes in, then the benefit stays. And I don't quite understand it. And I don't understand the point behind it. But at the end of it, what he's done is he's going to spend a couple of bucks to make sure that folks get the food stamps that they've been getting for a little bit of time here. Now, he's not doing it because he's this benevolent soul. He's doing it because it's smart policy. You're keeping $300 million in your state's economy. that the small business owner who goes, hey, I'd like some more customers, goes, hey, $300 million in money going into the local economy, that can't be bad for me. Now, two other governors, I guess, have done it. You've got Daniel Malloy, the governor of Connecticut, who is spending $1.4 million on the LIHEAP to save about $70 million in food stamp benefits. And Andrew Cuomo, the governor of New York, who is spending somewhere in the $6 million to spare some, I guess, about $500 million to spare about 300,000 families in New York, the cuts that were imposed on by the Republicans and the Democrats when they came together on their budget on the farm bill there. So, you know, you look at this and you go, I don't understand how it's so convoluted. And you go back and you go, you know, how does all this stuff get so complicated? And I think that's part of the knock against some of these social programs. And I remember after the Bush collapse happened, I remember I had a couple of, I hesitate to call them friends, acquaintances, people I knew who tried to go through the welfare system, tried to navigate the hurdles and the obstacles that are deliberately put in the way of people so that they'll get frustrated and they'll go away. Because understand, that's the point of it. The point of it is that you'll get frustrated and you say, the heck with it, I don't need it, I'm going to do something else. Same thing with Corbett's asset test. Same thing with, you know, with all of these hurdles. It's to tear you down. It's to make people go, well, I'm not going to do that. So that there's an obstacle in the way. And to them, then that's a savings. Then they saved money. See, we saved money. They didn't take the benefit. And I'm of the mindset, you know, it's good for our economy. And I know that, you know, it sounds weird that we're going to give people money, going to give them food stamps, and we're going to give them things so that they spend. But understand, the very conservative Milton Friedman understood this idea that he had of a negative tax. That for business to work, to be business friendly, means to make sure that there's some economic activity for the businesses to be able to exist around. This isn't a difficult concept. It isn't radical. It isn't new. It just is. So when I see Corbett taking this and going, give him credit. Credit where credit is due. Now, is it campaign related? I would argue it probably is. I would argue it's most certainly campaign related. But whatever the reason, I think it's good for our Commonwealth. I think it's good for the state. I think it's good for small business. I think it's good for families. I think it's good for kids. I think it's right. And you go, well, how is it good to get people welfare? And I've had this conversation 1,000 times. Of, you know, I choose not to focus on people like me when I was a kid, who the only way that there was food on the table some months is because we got help. We got the assistance that we needed, the hand up. The big problem here, no jobs. The big problem is, I don't know if you've looked at, because I look at the want ads. There aren't that many jobs there. I mean, I remember back, you know, in the 90s, you would open up the Help Wanted section, and man, there would be columns and columns and columns of jobs and different opportunities and stuff to do. Not so much. And the quicker we move towards mechanization, and you go back to the stimulus money, oddly enough, some of the stimulus money was used to get rid of some jobs, to mechanize stuff. So whatever it is that made Tom Corbett do the right thing in this vein, good for him. I still don't think it's going to help him in November. But on this moment, good for him. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around.
Thought-provoking, opinionated, Rick Smith. In 1897, miners at collieries throughout northeastern Pennsylvania's anthracite coal region had had enough. Conditions were grueling and life was difficult. Miners were frequently cheated out of pay, overcharged for supplies, some they never wanted or received, forced to live in captive company-owned towns, shop at overpriced company-owned stores, even mandated to use the company doctor since fees were deducted automatically from the miner's pay. This, combined with mine owners forcing longer unpaid hours and the Anti-Immigrant Campbell Act of 1897, taxing mine owners for the use of non-native labor, drove miners to strike. Spontaneously starting in Pennsylvania's Lehigh Valley, workers marched north to get other miners to join in the struggle. Their demands were modest, a 10-cent pay raise and a reduction in the cost of gunpowder. They also wanted the freedom to shop in non-company-owned stores of their choosing and see a doctor not owned by the coal company. As the miners moved northward toward Hazleton, mine owners, determined to crush the workers' protest, sent their company-paid police force and strikebreakers. Local law enforcement was also on the side of mine owners. Luzerne County Sheriff James Martin, a former mine foreman, deputized 102 local men, arming them with Winchester rifles and sidearms. The group of some 400 miners marching peacefully and unarmed in rows of fours moved onward toward Latimer. Stephen Urich, joining the group outside of Hazleton, taking with him the American flag, shouted, "We have nothing to worry about because we have the American flag to protect us." Within hours and a hail of Winchester bullets, Stephen Urich was gunned down in cold blood, his beloved American flag drenched in his blood and the blood of those who lay murdered and wounded. Eyewitnesses said the sheriff and his hired killers mowed the men down like grass. More than 20 men were murdered on that September day, and more than 50 were wounded, many shot in the back in labor's forgotten massacre. The sheriff and his murderous band were tried for their part in the Latimer massacre and found not guilty of murdering 20 unarmed peaceful demonstrators. Lest we never forget, or as the wife of a miner whose life was stolen from him told her children, "You can forgive, but you can't forget." This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.ricksmithshow.com.
Tales of American Political History with Clinton Porter Hackney.
We've been discussing the tariff on vegetable imports that eventually led to a legal battle in the U.S. Supreme Court. After hearing definitions of a veritable stew of fruits and vegetables, a U.S. Circuit Court judge found that botanists consider tomatoes a fruit, but the commonly accepted category was that a tomato is a vegetable and ordered Nix to pay the tariffs. Nix appealed to the Supreme Court of the land. Justice Horace Gray served 20 years on the U.S. Supreme Court. He wrote more than 450 opinions, including very significant cases. Now, in 1893, he would have to decide whether a tomato was a vegetable or a fruit. To Justice Gray, neither the botanist nor the dictionary definitions provided the answer. Gray wrote that what mattered was whether the congressman that imposed the tariff would have thought a tomato was a vegetable. Join us again for Gray's ruling. This is Clinton Porter Hackney at cphackney.com.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
Oh, yeah, another one. I look at this, and I remember when Big Eddie, I guess Big Eddie's had another big awakening. Ed Schultz came out not too long ago saying he was supporting building the Keystone XL. Now, I've been crystal clear and very, very consistent on the pipeline issue, which has gotten me into some trouble because there are some people who say, we need the jobs. And I agree, we need the jobs, but it's a false choice in my view. This is not something that is exclusive of anything else. We can still build stuff, but does it have to be this? And I think Alan Grayson probably hit it best. I think it was Grayson who said that, basically we're going to build a pipeline from Canada right through the middle of the U.S. to serve China. And that's kind of the way I see it, that we're going to set all this up. We're going to cut right down the middle of the country and basically just be a pass-through. A pass-through that's going to be the one that ends up with the few line right down the middle of the country, and the spills that we know come. You know it's going to happen. Now, Big Eddie, he says that, well, he had this kind of an epiphany that, you know, there's this big aquifer. It's where the big water supply is. I guess he went to Nebraska and had some people say, hey, you know, this is what's going on. So he had this epiphany. And good for him. I mean, you know, it's eventually you come around to the right side of the issue. Eventually you get there. And one of the things I you know, there are a lot of people who beat up on Schultz. One of the things I give him credit for is, you know, sometimes when he's wrong, he will come around. He does have these epiphanies one way or the other. You decide which way you want to go with that, and that's what you've got. But to me, again, we've been fed this false choice. This, you know, well, we got to have this because it's going to help us not see another Ukraine. I think one of the dumber statements I've seen on the whole Ukraine thing has been, we need to build the Keystone XL pipeline. Because that would show Putin that we're willing to drill. Now, I've been saying for years we need to be energy independent. And there's a way to do that, but you've got to have the vision and the foresight. And I thought Obama had started to do some of that. And then, well, you've got Solyndra, and you've got all of this stuff that the Republicans keep throwing out. I keep going after him over. And, you know, I don't like wasting money either. But the Solyndra thing for my T friends was not the scandal that the ISIS of the world wanted. In fact, none of the scandals that the ISIS of the world wanted were actually scandals. And this is what gets me. I mean, there are things to be really... Understand, I am somebody who looks at Obama as a mixed bag. Something good, something bad, something's really bad. And like we talked in the first hour, to Peter Van Buren. The whistleblower stuff, horrible. The secrecy, horrible. The Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement, how that's going, horrible. But the fact that he's not really using the full power and weight of the federal government as the Bush years did to crush down on workers, and he doesn't choke on the rights of workers to organize, gives me hope. There are some decent appointments that I don't mind. Now, the most recent one that he tried to appoint that the Republicans blocked and seven Democrats blocked blows my mind. And I guess it's just one of those things to me is, a failure to understand the history of our country and that Constitution thing. I mean, that's the thing that gets me. They didn't vote for him because he defended a cop killer. Let that sink in for a second, because understand, one of the core foundations of our nation is the right to represent, to counsel, the right to our day in court, the right to the best defense legally possible, the right not to have our rights just trampled over. And look, he defended the guy. He lost. Guy went to jail. And last time I checked, still locked up in jail. So now you're going to say the guy that defended him and did what I think is an American thing. He's being put down. And I think back, you know, and yesterday I couldn't help but think of, since it was the anniversary of the Boston Massacre, to think back to John Adams, who, you know, one of my favorite presidents. Not for good reasons, though. Well, maybe for one. I mean, the fact that he relinquished power, I think that's an amazing, an enormous feather in his cap. I mean, the Aliens and Sedition Act, locking up newspaper editors, no, not so big on that. Mandating that cannons go off whenever he comes to town, not so thrilled about that. But, you know, a couple other things. But he represented the people who shot and killed the Crispus Attucas. he defended them. And as I remember, he actually won. So what does that say about us? What does it say about who we've put into power that we don't, that it's all about the game? And, you know, I think it'd be well worth the time to go back and listen to the conversation I had with Susie Madrick at the top of the second hour. Because our politics have turned into this game that my team wins. And I've never been that team mentality guy. I've always been, there are good issues, there are right issues, there are things that we should be doing as a matter of course. You know, someone asked me, you know, a while ago, you know, well, politically, what are you? And I said, I'm a green liberal libertarian conservative. If it's a good idea, it's a good idea. If we've allowed certain things to be the purview of conservative ideology that are good ideas, then on that issue, I'm conservative. Like, we've said that paying the bills is somehow conservative. I don't agree. I think it's just right. But if it's conservative, then in that vein, I'm a conservative. I pay my bills every month. And I think we should, as a nation, pay our bills, which means bringing in more money if we have to. But on the energy front, this idea that somehow it's going to make us tough, somehow it's going to make us internationally respected if we destroy our environment, just seems kind of odd to me. Now, I was reading an article a little bit earlier today, and the wealthy in Chinese are leaving China because the air quality is so bad. And they're going, because they've got the resource, they can leave. I mean, they've caused all of this degradation. They've caused all of this destruction. They can get up and leave anytime they want. And then they do like Rex Tillerson said. Oh, you're not going to build anything to do fracking in my neighborhood. I'm Rex Tillerson. I bought my $5 million house so I didn't have to deal with you people. We want clean air and clean water in my neighborhood. And really, that's what the thing with Schultz is. He went to Nebraska, talked to the people there, said, hey, look, we've got this aquifer. We've got this water supply. We've got this that if you build this, it's going to screw things up. And it's a huge, huge supply of water. It's the Ogallala or something like that. O-G-A-L-L-A-L-A. Ogallala aquifer, which I guess most of the region it covers. So when you booger that up, what then? Are they going to come in and clean that up? No. Are they going to have to drink it? Are they going to have the freedom water like the people in West Virginia? And the answer is no. They're not going to be the ones vomiting uncontrollably. And that's always been my knock against it. Look, one, show me you can do it without boogering up my water. Well, you can't. You're never going to make it to where the water's not going to get screwed up. And then show me how it's going to benefit us. Okay, there are jobs. There are some jobs. And I give you that. I would love to build stuff. So how about we just build the pipeline and we don't take the oil through it? If you really want to build something. The other part of it is, how does it benefit us as a nation? Is it going to lower our energy prices any? The whole idea of being energy independent is that it doesn't bankrupt us. And that as wherever the price goes, it benefits us. Us. Not these huge multinational corporations, because look, ExxonMobil is no more an American company than any of the other oil companies, than BP or Royal Dutch Shell or any of those. So for me, Big Eddie's big awakening, good for him. Finally, he's on the right side of an issue. Pretty simple stuff. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Not right wing. Just right. The Rick Smith Show.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm John Kerr. Representative Paul Ryan, chairman of the House Budget Committee, helped kick off the Conservative Political Action Conference with a speech that dismissed the importance of programs for low-income Americans. He implied that low-income parents don't care for their children if they can't afford to send their kids to school with brown bag lunches.
He once met a young boy from a very poor family, and every day at school, he would get a free lunch from a government program. He told Eloise he didn't want a free lunch. He wanted his own lunch. One in a brown paper bag, just like the other kids. He wanted one, he said, because he knew a kid with a brown paper bag had someone who cared for him.
On Fox's Happening Now, correspondent Carl Cameron, reporting from CPAC, characterized Ryan's speech as taking a middle-of-the-road tone. Ryan's dismissal of school lunch programs ignores the 3.9 million children in America who were food insecure in 2012 and 15.9 million who lived in food insecure households, according to the USDA. For more on this and other stories, please visit MediaMatters.org.
A corporate lobbyist recently admitted to the New York Times, everybody is embarrassed about it, although not so embarrassed that they don't do it. It is the scandalous copulation between corporate cash and willing legislators that's taking place regularly in such secretive rendezvous resorts as the Dorado Beach Ritz-Carlton. Lawmakers and lobbyists don't like to talk about what they're doing and certainly don't want voters or the media to see them, for these getaways are explicit, tawdry examples of the prostitution of our legislative system. If you had wandered innocently into the Tony Four Seasons Hotel of Vail, Colorado in early January, you could have witnessed one of these group gropes. Assorted lobbyists, including one who represents the utility giant, PPL Corporation, had slipped tens of thousands of dollars into the political pockets of Representative Ed Whitfield and four other House members for the pleasure of rubbing elbows, wining and dining, and whispering sweet legislative nothings to them for hours. At one dinner, the cozy group dug into juicy Wagyu steaks and swilled $60 a bottle wine as they played scratch-my-back Washington-style politics. Whitfield, a Kentucky Republican, was especially popular with the utility lobbyists, for he chairs the House committee that handles legislation affecting, guess who, utilities. And Ed must have had a good time in Vail, because when he returned to Washington, he promptly introduced a bill to let PPL and other electric utilities build additional polluting, coal-burning power plants, an industry favor that would overturn health protections recently approved by the Obama administration. This is Jim Hightower saying, sure, the public approval rating for Congress is at historic lows, but the veiled experience of Whitfield and the others just shows that lawmakers can be lovable. You just have to know the price. Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
Most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick, at TheRickSmithShow.com. So the big news in D.C., obviously, the CPAC, the crazy people, it's convention or whatever you want to call it. But the hilarity never ends, and I can't wait to go home and flip on C-SPAN and watch some of it. But here to maybe give us a little taste before I get home, I've got Justin Duckham, Talk Radio News Service. Justin, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, great to be here. As you mentioned, the circus did come to town, and a yearly event that I kind of describe as a comic book convention, but without the comic books.
Yeah. These are the kind of things that where I wish I lived in D.C. that I could attend these things.
It was fun for the first 3 years, but this is probably my fifth or sixth one, and I'm sort of sick of it.
No, I wish to do, because I do Radio Rose on a whole bunch of different things. I would love to go there and just sit and mock them for an entire 3 hours. But then they might shoot me, though.
Yeah, I'm sure they would. That was a pretty conservative lineup today on Radio Row. Overall, it was a pretty interesting day. We had 2016 contenders. Chris Christie and Rubio, as well as Rand Paul appearing to give addresses that were, you know, pretty well received, but not necessarily make headlines. Mitch McConnell grabbed a lot of attention by strutting on stage with the rifle, holding it aloft, and then giving it to Senator Tom Coburn, who was leaving at the end of his term. This, of course, is sort of a nod to the gun fanatics that he needs to appeal to, you know, in this tough re-election battle. And, you know, we found out yesterday, or later in the day, that it was, in fact, a gift from the NRA, and McConnell was just presenting it to Coburn.
Nice. So it wasn't even a gift from McConnell. It was just him being the errand boy.
Exactly. And it made for a, you know, I don't want to say it was a pretty good photo op, since, you know, the idea of Mitch McConnell holding a rifle kind of, you know, smacks a little bit like Dukakis in the tank. So, you know, time, of course, will tell on that one to see if it actually helps. And, you know, we also saw speeches today from Wayne LaPierre, who really kind of went beyond just guns and, you know, really went after the administration for the IRS, you know, hoax, you know, the NSA, all that stuff. Warned that the greatest threat to America isn't Obama, you know, taking the guns away, which he has been wanting for quite some time, but instead a second Clinton presidency. And then a little bit later in the day, we got Donald Trump, who gave sort of a weird rambling speech wherein he, you know, asserted that Putin actually gave him a gift not too long ago, and, you know, to show how much he's respected by Putin, whereas he is toying with Obama, as Trump put it. He also, you know, lashed out against China, but also, you know, said he's, you know, pretty friendly with a lot of Chinese businessmen. And he, you know, just sort of went down familiar Trump territory, but sort of strayed away from some of the strange birther stuff we've seen in recent years.
Yeah, that you would expect from the Donald. You know what I find interesting, though, that LaPierre didn't give Coburn the gun himself. And from what I've heard, now this is just, you know, what I've read and what I've heard from several different sources, is that LaPierre is not allowed to have a gun. No one's allowed to be anywhere near him with a gun. He's not supposed to be near one because evidently he's fairly dangerous. A couple of the stories I heard when they were, I guess they were recording a couple of TV commercials, and he actually pointed the gun at the camera people when they said something that startled him. He turned, aimed right at the people with the gun. Instead of putting it down to look at them, aimed it right at him. Evidently, he's a nightmare with a gun. But, you know, hey, it's all about the perception. It's all about the image.
That's certainly interesting. Also, in you know, I guess other CPAC news, I got to briefly sit down with Michelle Bachmann.
Oh, she gave me
2.5 minutes.
Oh, man.
Yep.
I love Michelle Bachmann.
Yeah, well, I mean, she's always sort of a rock star there. Like, you know, these are really her people, so she's always being flocked and, you know, being surrounded for photos and whatnot. So I was pretty lucky to get a minute or two with her. I asked her if she, you know, has any plans for running for higher office in the future. She said not in the near term, but that she's leaving the door open for a future run. I asked what it would take for her to run for something again, and she replied that it would be, and I quote, an act of God. So a pretty Michelle Bachmann-y statement right there.
Yeah, I would expect that, and a whole ton of money. But what I find interesting is that you didn't get a chance to ask her that, what about a woman serving in the, being president? Even though, you know, she ran for president.
I did not have enough time to ask that. No, I was, you know, pretty much solely focusing on, you know, what exactly was going to happen to her. Because, you know, we see this happen a lot where there's sort of a Tea Party, you know, rock star. They sort of take up a lot of public space, and then they fade into utter obscurity. You know, we've seen that happen with Herman Cain. You know, not as much with Sarah Palin, but you know, actually Palin to a certain extent. And, you know, she's sort of going in a similar route where she's going to open up a PAC. She's going to try to use her fundraising ability and help other candidates while, you know, not serving in Congress.
Yeah, well, it should be interesting. I know she's not going away, but it should be interesting to see how crazy he does after this. Anything on the IRS hearing yesterday? I mean, because, you know, I saw the vote today in the House where they wanted to, you know, just kind of slap Daryl Issa just a little bit on the, maybe not even a slap, maybe just a touch on the wrist, and the Republicans repelled that action. Because I got to tell you, you know, watching the video of Issa being the chairman of that committee, there's no way that guy belongs anywhere near the chairmanship.
Yeah, I mean, at a certain point, you know, you kind of have to respect the, you know, duties of the ranking member. If we have a situation where They're completely cut out of the system. That's certainly not helping anybody. And that's what it looked like yesterday. You know, we saw the mic being cut for, you know, Mr. Cummings. We saw him just being barely written off. And we saw just, you know, flat-out theatrics coming from Daryl Issa. So he certainly didn't really look like the, you know, sort of victor that I'm sure he imagined himself to be just yesterday.
Yeah, I mean, and the other part of it is it's not so much even just cutting off Cummings' mic as it was he was, like, standing there mocking him. I mean, you couldn't hear what he was saying, but you know he was... Yeah, he was talking smack.
Exactly. You know, this really shows, you know, how hard, how hot the tension between the two members of the committee has grown. You know, we know that there's been action from the, you know, minority members of the committee to try to, you know, subpoena documents, to leak documents that the majority didn't want. We've seen ISA, of course, coming out with, you know, pretty bogus hearings into things like the IRS scandal or Benghazi or, you know, of course, Fast and Furious, which was his major, you know, feather in his hat. And it wasn't necessarily surprising to see this sort of meltdown today.
Yeah. So I'm sure there was an awful lot of talk about what was going on in Ukraine. I find it interesting, you know, that, you know, at a time when, you know, we need to have some unity, I guess, behind the president. All I keep hearing from my political right is, you know, how weak he is. And you got Palin saying, oh, he wears mommy pants. And then the Benghazi. And I'm sure the IRS had something to do with Putin taking over or trying to take over Crimea. Any of that stuff? I can't imagine there wasn't.
You know, it's been continuing. Yesterday, actually, we got some comments from Robert Gates, the former defense secretary, who was at one point one of two Republicans to serve in the Obama administration. And he called on John McCain and Lindsey Graham and some of these more strident voices in the Senate to tone down their rhetoric, lest they egged Obama into a pretty dangerous situation with Ukraine. You know, beyond that, though, we did actually see a rare moment of bipartisanship take place today in the House. We saw them vote by about 385 to 23 to approve a $1 billion aid package for Ukraine. This, of course, is aimed at reestablishing their economy, which, of course, is very shaky following all the turbulence that they've experienced. And that, as I mentioned, passing is now on its way to the Senate, where it will almost surely pass as well.
Yeah, I mean, the whole situation in Ukraine, you're talking about the whole economy is shaky from the start. And, you know, as I've been watching this and I've been thinking it through, I think a lot of it has to do with, you know, I think Russia offered them a much better deal, and we didn't. In fact, you know, what we got to sell off all of their state assets, sell off all of their stuff, and privatize, and we see how well privatization is done here.
Yeah, exactly. No, that's been, you know, the issue from day one. That's what really spurred a lot of these protests, the decision between Russia and the EU. And it's not surprising now that we are trying to sort of sweeten the deal as, you know, we now see Russia's advance.
So no more, we've done something we can't, people from Russia can't come. We've blocked some visas or something. Explain that.
I'm actually not as fully read in this as I should be. But this has been something that has been talked about for a while. This is from the EU to try to prohibit, you know, passports into Ukraine, I believe. I don't know much more beyond just the headline that you mentioned.
Yeah. Interesting. I can't wait for tomorrow, the CPAC. Will you be there tomorrow?
I will not be, but Jeff Holtzman will be, and he will be updating the site throughout the day with more of the ever entertaining, crazy stuff.
More of the circus. Justin, it's always great talking with you. I appreciate you taking time for us.
Thank you, Rick.
Justin Duckham, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. For working people, time to talk.
Radio of, for, and by We the Working People. The Rick Smith Show.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe?
AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. North America's building trades unions oppose President Obama's budget recommendation to privatize the Tennessee Valley Authority. Building trades unions president Sean McGarvey says the unions find the proposal extremely disturbing in light of the Obama administration having consistently praised TVA's efforts in improving its finances while acknowledging the benefits of TVA's public power model. Since TVA gets no taxpayer dollars, McGarvey says the building trades unions failed to understand the logic behind the privatization recommendation. The building trades unions are challenging Obama to present a case as to why this is nothing more than a poorly crafted budget gimmick that won't save money, but will cost jobs. The United Food and Commercial Workers Union is in talks with California's largest grocery store chains for a new labor contract covering some 60,000 workers. The negotiations with Ralph's, Vons, and Albertsons have just gotten started. The union has sent a proposal to the stores. Talks are scheduled for this month and for April. The old contract with the three grocery chains expired March 2nd. Working America is celebrating the election of Santa Fe Mayor Javier Gonzalez. The community affiliate of the AFL-CIO fielded organizers who had 5,000 face-to-face conversations with voters across Santa Fe about why Gonzalez was the best working family candidate on the ballot. Working America's 110,000 members in New Mexico are mobilizing around issues like increasing the minimum wage, getting paid sick days, creating good quality jobs, and improving public education. Working America is a nonprofit organization for people without the benefit of a union on the job. Wisconsin Republicans have removed State Representative Bill Kramer as State Assembly Majority Leader in response to allegations of sexual harassment and assault made against him. But Democrats say that's not enough. Wisconsin Assistant Assembly Democratic Leader Sandy Pasch.
Unfortunately, this reprehensible behavior does not exist in a vacuum. This is a continuation of an established pattern of Wisconsin Republicans' callous treatment of women in our state. Not only did Republicans elevate someone with a well-known history of inappropriate behavior towards women to a leadership role, we've seen the legislature time and time again wage an unprecedented, ideologically driven agenda that allows government to control the decisions of women across our state and severely impact their well-being.
U.S. House Republicans voted Wednesday for the 50th time to delay part of the Affordable Care Act, voting to delay penalties for lacking coverage. Americans United for Change says that would mean leaving an additional million Americans without health insurance. So far, 4 million people have enrolled to get health insurance through the health care reform law. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo wants stronger federal regulations for rail safety, citing frequent train derailments involving transportation of crude oil over the past year. Governor Cuomo is calling on the feds to move swiftly to improve safety and increase the number of rail safety inspections. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. Something on your mind, you can email me, Rick at therickssmithshow.com. I got an email during the break that alerted me to I didn't know Jesse Ventura was still doing reality TV shows. Evidently, he's doing this program called Off the Grid. I'm not sure if that's that conspiratorial thing he was doing or whatever it was. I know he was doing something for a while. It was like a conspiracy. I thought that was called conspiracy or something along those lines. But I like Jesse. He can go off into the crazy sometimes, but he's a guy who's going to tell you like he sees it, and I respect that. Absolutely respect that. He brought up this interesting couple of statements. On the show Off the Grid, he basically called BS on the idea that the very wealthy in the country, they earn their money. Because he said, he goes, I don't think what's wrong with these, I don't think that's what's wrong with these one percenters, that they have so much money that they couldn't spend in their lifetime or their grandchildren's lifetime, but it's truly becomes a sickness walk. He says, you know, he looks at the ultra rich as, you know, a sickness and dangerously addicted to money. He points out that when questioned about this idea, because we hear this all the time, and I've had this thrown at me. Well, you know, the very wealthy, they work hard for their money. They earn their money just like you do. Well, they threw it out to him, and he kind of laughed at the idea that the 1% work harder than anyone else. He says, is it work pushing numbers around on a paper or moving decimal points, or is it work washing dishes and digging ditches? He says, because I highly doubt that any of these 1%ers, I'd love to know how many of them began like I did as a kid at Mama Rose's restaurant washing dishes for $1.50 an hour. That's work, he says. And it's hard work washing dishes, them dishes all day long, as it would be doing what these CEOs do. And really poorly written sentence. but you know, the thing is, and the point I think is important, you know, this idea that somehow you can have somebody who's making millions of dollars a year. And I look at the fast food industry, because this is one of the more recent conversations I've had on this difference between people who work for a living and the CEO class. How is it that the person who's that person who hands me the bag out the window or cooks whatever it is, how is it that they're worth $7.58 an hour? Yet the guy who's shuffling papers around and I get the idea, well, he's making decisions. Well, you know, most of the time a board does that. How is it that the CEO is making $10, $15, $20, $50, $100 million? I mean, you look at some of the obscene amounts of money that people are taking out of these companies. And it's not their companies. I mean, that's the thing that gets me. You know, I guess you could almost make an argument if you had a sole proprietorship and the guy at the top was pocketing the profits. It's his company. But most of these are publicly traded. They're public companies. And, you know, as publicly traded companies, don't you think at some point they should benefit the public? But he hits on a couple of things. He says, you know, I've been a CEO. They don't get their hands dirty very often. He said they go to all sorts of free meals all the time. They may put in the time and the effort, but what do you define as work? He said, well, maybe it's mental work, but it's certainly not physical. And, you know, I bring it back to the Social Security. I guess it's easy for someone who sits in an office and, you know, easy for someone who now sits behind a microphone, which I am not advocating that we change the retirement age at all. In fact, I'm of the mindset we should be lowering it to get more people to retire. But here's the thing. When you're doing less strenuous jobs physically, it's easy to advocate for, well, let's push that retirement age off to 70 years old, where Pat Robertson said, well, you know, let's push it off to 72 or, you know, 100, because people don't want to sit around and rust out. People like to work, according to Pat Robertson. But if you're doing a manual job, if you're a construction worker, you're a truck driver, you're lifting boxes in a warehouse, you're not going to do that into your 60s and 70s as well as you did in your 20s. And what happens in our society, and, you know, I just had this conversation with my aunt who's just turned 65. And she's like, you know, you can't get a job anywhere, because if you're not in your 20s and 30s anymore, they're not hiring. And that's the other interesting part. Because a lot of the long-term unemployed, and I'm going to bring up the unemployment extension again, which we should be doing forthright. It should be done already. They should have never left for Christmas break without making sure that those folks were taken care of. Because they made sure they took care of themselves, didn't they? But a lot of the unemployment problems are folks who have been... I mean, the people that I've met over the last couple of years who have been long-term unemployed are folks who've never collected unemployment before. They've never had. They don't know how to act. They don't know how to respond. They've always had a job. They've always been able to pull themselves, and now they're the targets They're the targets of, oh, well, you know, they're lazy, or they're the targets of, you know, like Corbett said.
There are many employers that say, you know, we're looking for people, but we can't find anybody that has passed the drug test.
Yeah, I mean, they're just lazy or stupid or drug addicts that can't pass a drug test. I mean, really, think about this for a minute. I mean, that's where they're taking us. And as I step back and I look at 5, 10, 15 years down the road, which I don't know that anyone's doing right now, I don't even know that the conservative think tanks are now thinking down the road, because they've accomplished most of what their mission was. You know, you stop and you think about 40 years ago when all of these think tanks and all of these right-wing groups sprouted up through massive investment through the business community. And the Reagan ideology was being formed. Understand, Reagan didn't come to this stuff by himself. These politicians don't make this stuff up by themselves. It's stuff that they buy into. It's other people's stuff. They go, here, this is what you should believe. And if you don't believe it, we're not going to fund you. The whole privatization, the whole scheme towards destroying the commons. This idea that we need to lower taxes. And at the beginning of the program, as I said, you know, this CPAC conference. Anything new going to come out of this? Any ideas, any vision for the future other than the same tired, failed ideology of, well, we need lower taxes. Well, how much lower? We need to deregulate. Well, how much more do we need to deregulate? Do we just, you know, turn our backs and like in the 40s and 50s? Ah, dump all you want. Ah, that, you know, those heavy metals that you're dumping in the water, well, that just adds a little extra flavor to it, a little oomph to it. Very interesting. And I mean, I think we need to be having these conversations. And in a sane, rational tone. I mean, you know, I look at what's going on at the CPAC conference and these people just really obscene in a lot of the stuff that's going on. And it's time that we put a stop to it. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com, that's where you go to get the podcast. Stitcher on the smartphone. You can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Thanks for being here. Appreciate it. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
It's coming from the wind. You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tidal flood beneath the Buddha's sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous array. Democracy is coming to the USA.
Thank you all very much. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff. Thanks to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and ACACT.org. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you.